You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Week of December 4th, 2015. My name is Mike Biggs. Today we feature an interview with activist Michelle Gross on tracking police violence against Black Lives Matter protesters in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Then, we'll feature a report on how the U.S. National Security State has been tracking Black Lives Matter and other grassroots groups in the name of fighting terror. And later, we'll speak to the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council in Paris, heading a delegation at the climate talks in Paris. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's show with an interview from Monday's program with activist Michelle Gross on tracking police violence against Black Lives Matter protesters in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Joining us now is Michelle Gross, and we go back to Minneapolis where things are still hot as people are camped out in front of the police department, last I heard anyway. And again, joining us from that city is Michelle Gross. Michelle Gross works with communities against police brutalities, is that right?
Communities United Against Police Brutality, and I'm the president of the group.
Welcome, and thank you for coming back. First of all, give us an update. Is the encampment still there? I know the officials want you to take it down. Give us an update.
It is alive and well, thank you very much. People are resisting the calls. Of course the officials want people to take it down. You know, they're ready to return to, business as usual, but people are not ready to go back to business as usual, especially because a couple of things have happened. One is that the prosecutor has announced that that he will be seeking a grand jury indictment. And of course, what we know is that grand jury is code language for I'm not going to charge the cops and I'm going to make sure they don't get charged. So of course, people are very upset about that. And, you know, that's raised the level of resistance in the community. The other thing that's happened is that those individuals who shot people last Monday, a week ago, at the encampment were charged today. And they were charged with very minor charges. It's really outrageous. The police have video, they have email, they have evidence that these individuals, because I have that evidence, these individuals pre-planned this attack. It was an attempted murder. They talked about killing specific individuals, by description and things like that. It was clearly premeditated, and they barely charged them with assault. I mean, it was not, one of them, the charges was like attempted riot with a gun or something. I mean, that's so ridiculous, but,
Were they felonies or misdemeanors? Felonies or misdemeanors? Were they felonies or misdemeanors?
Misdemeanors.
So they were charged. Well, you know what? Let me ask you to step back. Remind people what happened in terms of the killing of this young man, and then tell us more about the incident that these guys are being charged with misdemeanors. I mean, it's if they were. Anyway, go on, please.
Right, if there were anybody else, I know what you're saying. So what happened first is on December 15th, I should look at that date. It was two Sundays ago. November 15th, excuse me. An individual named Jamar Clark was basically gunned down by police. He was trying to break up a fight between his girlfriend and somebody else, and the ambulance came because the girlfriend was injured in that fight. And he was trying to speak to his girlfriend who was on the ambulance, and the ambulance drivers didn't like that, so they called police. We have reason to believe the police were already there. They had him handcuffed and on the ground, and they basically shot him in the head while he was on the ground. There were many witnesses to this. A lot of the witnesses have been intimidated into not coming forward because they had their video, their camera, their cell phones taken away from them. They were told, you better not say what you know, or, you're going to end up like that kid over there. This kind of stuff like that. So a lot of witness intimidation in the immediate aftermath. People had, pepper spray, guns, tasers pointed at them, basically, by a whole army of officers in the immediate aftermath. So this has touched off, you know, great anger in the community. And the community, you know, wants answers. We have, it took them nearly 5 days, about 5 days, to release even the names of the officers. We still don't know which of the two officers was the one who did the shooting. We do know that these officers have had a number of lawsuits against them. These are bad actors in the community that have been very harmful to the community, yet they've had little to no discipline. So like I said, people are very frustrated, upset. The city refuses to release video that they could release, and they are being very tight-lipped about details, except the details they want to put out, which are things that are basically character assassinations of Jamar Clark. Then we've got this encampment. So people, in their anger, formed an encampment. And this encampment has been going strong now for 2 weeks. And literally, you know, people are trying to get the encampment to go home, but it keeps getting bigger and bigger. Last Monday, possibly four individuals atop the encampment. They'd been coming around, and people had a lot of suspicions about these guys. You know, they looked, they had tried to make themselves look like activists, but they just didn't look right, you know, and they just, their behavior and the way they were talking to people. And it turned out that people were tracking them by email, and they are avowed KKK members and other white supremacists. And they were involved in, like I said, white supremacy organizing, and literally talked about picking off this person and that person by description. And then last Monday they did it.
So it was a premeditated shooting. It was a premeditated shooting against unarmed civilians. This isn't
the... That's right. They just literally just shot into the crowd, shot five people. All five ended up going to the hospital. Two were not very badly injured. But one gentleman was had surgery and is still in the hospital. You know, he was shot in the abdomen. This was serious attacks on people, you know, with grievous bodily harm to at least one individual. Another gentleman was shot through his kneecap. He'll never walk the same way again. You know, so these were serious injuries. And for the county attorney to level these low-level charges, people are very frustrated. It's cold here. We've got snow on the ground, but people are still at the encampment, and they intend to stay.
Now, was there a press conference in terms of these charges being announced, or it was just a matter of course?
The county attorney had a press conference, and he had very, you know, mamby-pamby stuff to say about why, you know, oh, we've charged these guys. You know, the charges they leveled were not even close to appropriate for what these people did. Not even close to appropriate. You know, so this is the open season on activists here in the Twin Cities.
Wow. All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Michelle Gross in Minneapolis, one of the Twin Cities. We're talking about a killing that eyewitnesses are saying was happened as somebody was being held and handcuffed. He was certainly overwhelmed by the police. There's no doubt that this guy presented any more danger when he was murdered by the police.
That's right. He was pinned to the ground at least, and probably handcuffed based on many witness statements.
All right. And where does this go from there? What's happening in the community? What are people saying?
Well, people are still demanding that they drop the idea of this grand jury, because everybody knows in every case, I mean, you have to think about all of the different cases in which, you know, grand juries were convened. We've had virtually every single killing by a police officer in this state has gone to a grand jury, and we have not had one single grand jury indictment come down against a police officer in a brutality or, you know, killing by police in over 150 years, as far back as we could find. We had not had one single indictment come back on the police. So this is a formula for giving these guys, you know, a free pass for them to get to walk, and it's unbelievable to us. So we're going to be fighting very hard to, you know, no grand jury. We also have a lot of questions, a lot of doubts about the quality of the investigation that's happening. The FBI is doing a tandem investigation with the BCA, which is like our state version of the FBI, but it's a version that no one trusts. Everybody believes that the BCA is super biased, and there's lots of evidence that they are. But yet, instead of doing their own investigation, the FBI is actually sitting there and taking witness statements with the BCA at the same time. And we don't think that that's a proper investigation, so we're getting very concerned about it. You know, I think people ought to know that if if they don't do what they're supposed to do in this case, then the community is going to go, you know, this is going to get serious. I mean, it's serious now, but it's going to get a lot worse because people are not going to tolerate it this time.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And so, and you, is it sort of a community decision? It is a collective decision that the encampment will stay in front of the police department until some justice is manifest?
Yes. People are meeting twice a day at the encampment to make decisions about what to do about the encampment. You know, they had things, for example, there was a Thanksgiving dinner there on Thursday, and just hundreds of people showed up for this. They had more food. There was more food at the encampment than anybody could ever eat in a million years. You know, it's like, you know, people, like homeless folks were invited to come and partake because there was just tons of food. People all showed up with, you know, all manner of food for people to eat. And it was a huge celebration on Thursday. And so, you know, like I said, these decisions happen on a day-by-day basis with people at the encampment meeting, you know, a couple of times a day for a big group meeting where people decide, you know, what are we going to do next and what's, you know, what's the next action and where do we take this?
I'm wondering if people in Minneapolis are in communication with other communities around the country that have suffered this kind of violence. Is there a sense that people are working not only in your community but collectively across communities?
Oh, absolutely. There have been all kinds of solidarity events, in, you know, solidarity with the individuals who were shot by the white supremacists and solidarity to demand justice for Jamar Clark. Our organization, Communities United Against Police Brutality, is part of three national coalitions. So I've been in contact quite often with people around the country that want to know what's going on and, you know, offer their assistance and, you know, are talking about coming in to help and things like that. So, yes, very much so. We don't feel isolated at all here, and we're very grateful for the outpouring of support from across the country.
And, Michelle Gross, what's the best way for people to get information about what's happening there in Minneapolis, to get in touch with you, to see what your organization is doing?
Yes, they can contact us through our website. We have a contact form on our website, www.cuapb.org. So that's for Communities United Against Police Brutality, cuapb.org. And our hotline is area code 612-874-7867.
Now, I forgot, is this an isolated incident? I forgot to ask you this question earlier. Or is there a systematic abuse of people of color, of poor people, by the police there?
There's no question that this is absolutely systematic. We have a tremendous problem with police brutality here. Our city alone, just Minneapolis alone, pays out over $3,000 per officer per year for judgments and settlements in police brutality cases. And and they get tons of complaints. We have a complaint mechanism in Minneapolis that is so ineffective that in the last 2.5 years, they've taken in over 1,000 complaints, and they have sustained and disciplined one out of over 1,000 complaints. So there's no discipline here. There's no consequences for police who engage in this conduct, and therefore no incentive not to engage in that conduct. So we have a huge problem here. We have a serious problem. Minnesota, most people don't know, is just a tremendously racist state. We have the highest rates of over-prosecution of blacks in the entire country. We have our jails are, you know, far blacker than just about any other place in the country. We have a really serious issue here of racism. You know, people want to think it's like Minnesota nice and all of this stuff. It's not. We have a terrible problem here, and it starts with the police and works its way all the way through the criminal justice system. And it's a huge issue.
I have to tell you, I'm absolutely baffled that those shooters, those white supremacist shooters, premeditatively show up, shoot people, wound people seriously, and they get off with a misdemeanor. They'll probably cop a plea, do 15 hours of service, and be back with their weapons again.
You know, that's the whole thing, and it's frightening that these guys, I mean, they're going to make bail, and they're going to be back in the community again. And it's frightening to think about that, because they have literally, one of the people in our organization is one of the people that they targeted specifically. You know, he's what they call a high-value target in their language. And
what does that mean?
You know,
why is he high-value?
Well, that's their language. I don't know why they consider it a high value, but by the description, they could not be talking about anybody else. And so consequently, you know, we've been on a little bit higher level of security in our own organization, in our meeting space and things like that, and making sure that we take good care of him, because he's extremely knowledgeable, and I think that that's a lot of why they went after him. He's one of the people that's very knowledgeable in the community about policing, and so, you know, about kind of this whole issue. So, you know, it's amazing to me, like I said, that Mike Freeman, the county prosecutor, is actually going to help him do it. And that seems like what's going to happen. They're going to help him do it.
That's amazing. All right. Well, give us that 800 number again if people want to get information. Give us the information again. It's unbelievable.
Sure. Yeah, it's unfortunately not an 800 number. We're a small group that has no all volunteers, no paid staff, so we're a little group. But our number is 612-874-STOP. 612-874-7867. Or people could reach us through our website at www.cuapb.org.
You're listening to the best of Flashpoints of the week of December 4th, 2015. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we'll feature a report on how the U.S. national security state has been tracking Black Lives Matter and other grassroots groups in the name of fighting terror.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, now we turn our attention to the counterterrorism activities the feds conducted against what is a totally peaceful movement to shut down what is commonly known as the School of the Americas. Joining us to talk about this is Mar Verheiden Hilliard. She is the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, and they represent the School of the Americas Watch. This is the organization that organizes these protests every year, and they do it well. Let me quote the press release. Each November, the School of the Americas Watch organizes peaceful vigils and protests in Fort Benning, Georgia, where the U.S. Army trains Latin American military officials and dictators. Well, that is certainly guaranteed protest under the Constitution. Could you please lay out the situation, Ms. Hilliard, and tell us just sort of the thumbnail sketch?
Well, as you said, the School of the Americas Watch has for a long time organized peaceful, nonviolent dissent and opposition to the School of Americas, which has been renamed, but it's a U.S. Army training program that I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of, that trains and has trained many of the most violent, vicious violators of human rights throughout Latin America. It trains them, it seeds them throughout Latin America, those that have engaged in torture, in crimes against humanity. And this organization, is its mission in all of its demonstrated track record is completely peaceful. SOA Watch every year has a peaceful vigil at Fort Benning. And what we found, pursuing a Freedom of Information Act request at the behest of SOA Watch, was that the FBI had engaged in a 10-year-long monitoring and reporting operation on SOA Watch. They had for 10 years cataloged, reported, collected information, and had done so using their counterterrorism and domestic terrorism authority. Now, throughout the FBI documents, the FBI itself acknowledges year after year that the group is peaceful, that its activities are peaceful, and yet year after year they reauthorize continuing this kind of operation.
All right, let's be more specific. How exactly did this program work? How were these activists surveilled? I know that somebody who's a contributor to this show, Francisco Herrera, a troubadour, if you will, is down there every year. Were those conversations, his reports to us, if you will, monitored?
I don't know. We can only see what we can see from the documents that we have. And for people that are interested, we've made the documents publicly available, and they're completely searchable up on our website, which is justiceonline.org. So anyone that wants to look at the documents can go through them. But when you go through them, there are incidents where it's clear that they're monitoring individual people, that they're collecting information or reporting on individual people. But the main upshot is the fact of the operation, that they're setting up operations each year also at the location of the vigil, that they're coordinating with what appears to be military intelligence as well as the local police departments. And they justify this, and this is fairly significant, that they justify it because every year they say nothing violent happened, there's nothing that even remotely could approach terrorism, and every year they say even though it's completely nonviolent, even though they say that SOA Watch leaders express only peaceful intentions, that's the FBI words, they say that a militant group could infiltrate the protesters and use the cover of the crowd. And this is something that we've seen them do over and over again when they're monitoring peaceful political organizing in the United States, is always this justification is that, yes, everything's peaceful, but something could happen. Someone else could come in. And here they said there could be factions of a radical cell. It's always pretextual. And, of course, on that basis, there's nothing that can be free from FBI political surveillance.
Well, now, is there any indication that given that kind of assertion that they themselves felt compelled to infiltrate? We have heard all too often about agent provocateurs in contexts such as this.
I know that in our own work at the Partnership for Civil Justice, we've uncovered agent provocateurs over the years in the context of different mass gatherings and movements. So I don't think any of us would ever rule that out. We've not identified in this context anyone acting specifically as an agent provocateur, but of course that doesn't mean that such people don't exist. Their focus really seemed to be that they were keeping tabs on the group and reporting on the group. And I think in large part because it's the political nature of what was happening. You can see that they're starting to do this at a point in time where they're feeling the strength of the movement and the large numbers of people that were coming to Fort Benning. And it's not that because there were large numbers of people that somehow that was making it more violent. The large numbers of people were as equally violent as any other numbers of people, equally nonviolent. But it's that it was becoming a political force. And at the point at which any movement becomes a political force, it is almost automatic in the United States that the FBI turns its sights on them. We saw that when we did our investigation into the FBI monitoring of the Occupy movement. And again, you can see this with Black Lives Matter. It doesn't matter that the entities are peaceful and that the organizers are peaceful, because it's just a pretextual basis for the FBI to come in. They have to check a box saying that there could be violence or there could be crime. But it demonstrates completely the fact that the FBI is a political surveillance arm. It's not, quote-unquote, law enforcement. It's what it's going after is political surveillance, political intelligence gathering, political reporting on social justice movements in the United States.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Mara Verheiden Hilliard. She is the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, and we're talking about the way in which the feds and the counterterrorism structures of of the United States government monitored these yearly protests of the School of the Americas Watch. And it is revealing, and it does raise the question, why are they exerting so much resource? You began to talk to that, and but when you look at this, the School of the Americas Watch, or whatever it's called now, the Western Hemisphere for Security Cooperation, it's part of a structure of what the United States government has always done. I mean, I'm thinking about a story I did way back about Hector Gramajo going to the Kennedy School, the mass murderer, the general from Guatemala who led the slaughters in the Highland, is getting a master's from the Kennedy School. Now, when I went back to investigate this, what I learned about Hector Gramajo is that at every turn in his career, he was being groomed by the United States. He was being brought to study at different schools all the way up. He'd get promotions, go back in. Finally, he was at the Kennedy School getting ready to go back and run for office. Luckily, he never managed to win president, and I think he was literally stung to death by a hive of bees. But nevertheless, this is a structure, and that when these folks are at the School of the Americas, they're getting in the way of a permanent structure of the way the United States works.
And that's the reality of what the threat is that SOA Watch posed, such that the FBI wanted to target them. It isn't a threat of violence. It isn't a threat of property damage. It is a political threat. It's a strong political threat. And that's what happens at any point in time in which a social justice movement is becoming powerful, is becoming strong, is challenging what's happening in the United States. SOA Watch has been hugely successful in terms of its capacity to educate, mobilize people, and really put the spotlight on the U.S. government training these torturers, these death squad leaders, these murderers, and seeding them throughout Latin America to really act as agents of the U.S. government.
Right, so they always have a go-to guy on the ground.
Right. I mean, they get their training from the United States military. So it's the political threat. That's the thing that generates this. I mean, the fact is, the FBI, well, you had asked about Asian provocateurs, they did have confidential informants, and they were seeding confidential informants who were reporting on information about planning events in Massachusetts or the number of buses coming from around the country. And in some instances, the stuff that people are reporting on is material that, you know, would be plainly available as well, which also just shows kind of the whole bureaucratic nature of the surveillance state. And in some levels, it's, you know, remarkable incompetency, even while it is acting to repress the movement in the United States.
All right. Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Before I let you go, I do want to talk to you about Chicago. And let's just come through the door. You did mention, as you were talking, you know, political groups, they achieve a certain power, a certain organizational level, and here come the feds. That is the case with Black Lives Matter?
It's definitely the case with Black Lives Matter. And, you know, in the same way that we could see it with Occupy, you can see it with Black Lives Matter. At the moment that there is a fire lit in the streets in the United States where people feel the power of the people and they want to come together and they want to take collective action and they're going to demand change, is the moment that the fusion centers, which we've also documented, and the FBI.
Fusion center?
The fusion centers, which are a vast web of surveillance intelligence networks throughout the United States, the Department of Homeland Security generally funds, and that all the multiple intelligence agencies, law enforcement agencies, state and local agencies all feed into this. And we released materials about a year and a half ago where we sort of got the first window into the fusion centers. They're extremely secretive. We were able to get our hands on documents that really showed how they were operating, what they were reporting on. And over again, it's the same dynamic. And with Black Lives Matter, a movement that's, you know, shaking to the core the accepted system of police murder in the United States, racist police murder, and beyond that in terms of the fundamental underpinnings of racism in the United States, the FBI turns its head, as it always does, and begins collecting information.
And what exactly can you tell us about what they're doing with black? I imagine there's a whole bunch of them there in Chicago right now.
Well, you look at Chicago. I mean, this is one of the most significant moments, because the level of pressure and the resounding demands for resignation and firing of these top-level officials who are being caught and called out in what is an apparent and obvious cover-up. You know, this young man being shot down in the street, this police officer, and everybody there knew it. The mayor knew it. The state attorney knew it. They refused to release that video for 400 days. They had it. They knew for 400 days that they had a murder on their hands. They had a murderous cop, and they didn't want to do anything about it. They didn't want to do anything about it because of political expediency. They didn't want to do anything about it because it was an election. They didn't want to do anything about it because they bend over backwards to support the police union on their knees, as we see over and over again with municipalities on their knees before the police unions. And it's falling down around them in an amazing moment, and there's no doubt that the U.S. intelligence agencies are worried, are concerned, and are focused on what's happening in Chicago, because people have a righteous demand, and it's being heard nationwide.
And Ron Emanuel, the whole process, he says he didn't see it until now. He wanted to stay. He didn't want to taint the process. You believe any of that?
Nobody could possibly believe any of that. I mean, they had the video. They approved a $5 million settlement. There's no way that you're approving a $5 million settlement without knowing what it's for. And it's simply not credible. I don't think that anybody believes him. He's fired the police chief, the commander. He's, you know, hoping that he can weather out the storm. And it'll be a really interesting demonstration if the voices of the people are strong enough that he can't. And that goes for the state attorney as well. I mean, this is a murderous police force. Chicago is notorious, from, you know, the police torture cases to even more recently, you know, Rekia Boyd and the acquittal in her murder as well. It's a demand that people have been raising in Chicago for a long time, but now the voices are so strong, it's one that it's hard for the establishment even to turn its back on.
Well, we would love to continue this dialogue with you. Coming up next in this broadcast, by the way, the rest of the broadcast is going to be coming out of Chicago and is all about this. So you've opened the door. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, terrific work that you do as executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Amazing work. And again, people want to look at these documents. They're all up there, right? You've got them.
They're all there, and they're easily searchable. So, and we welcome people looking at them. And when people see things that are interesting that they want to draw our attention to, send us an email and let us know.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Be careful.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the best flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Finally, we feature an interview from Wednesday's program. We spoke to the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council in Paris, heading a delegation at the climate talks in Paris.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now take it to Paris, France, where the climate summit is in full progress and where there are many activists from around the world. We're delighted to be joined by Andrea Carmen. She's the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council, and she is there with a delegation from the Treaty Council in Paris, working with representatives of Native peoples from across the hemisphere. We're delighted for you to join us. Why don't you start, Andrea, by outlining why you're there and what's the agenda for Native peoples that you're representing?
Well, thank you for inviting me, and it's really important that we share what's happening here from the inside with everybody who's listening and everybody who is concerned about the climate crisis, which should be just about everybody by now. And very important what we're doing, and we're keeping our future generations first and foremost in our minds while we're doing this work over here. I'm one of two representatives on the Global Steering Committee for what's called the International Indigenous Peoples Forum on Climate Change, which represents Indigenous peoples from all seven Indigenous regions of the world. We have Indigenous peoples from North America, which is for the Global Steering Committee, is myself and Chief Bill Erasmus from the Dene Nation, Northwest Territories in Canada. And we have about 20 Indigenous peoples from North America with us, from U.S. and Canada, as well as from Mexico. We have delegates from Mexico. But there's also a big delegation from Latin America and Caribbean, also Pacific Islands, the Arctic, Africa, Asia, and Russia. So we're very excited to be working with a very large team here, and we all have collective consensus points that we're working with the country delegations. In the UN, they're called states, right? So it's confusing for the United States. It's not California or Arizona. It's the state here is the United States of America. And I was selected, very interestingly, by the whole Indigenous caucus that met on the weekend to finalize our positions and our strategy for getting the rights of Indigenous peoples recognized in the final legally binding agreement, being called the Paris Agreement, that'll come out hopefully by the end of the 2 weeks. But I was able to attend the opening plenary and heard in person President Barack Obama address the body, and Vladimir Putin, and Angela Merkel, and Prince Charles, and King of Jordan, and just many, many different heads of state that were here. The new Prime Minister from Canada, Prime Minister Trudeau, was here, and he did mention Indigenous peoples, which was really appreciated by the Canadian First Nations representatives that are here. And worked on them, I think, a bit to make sure that was in there. Unfortunately, not only did President Obama not mention human rights in his talk, he didn't mention Indigenous people's rights either, which we kind of hoped he would at least talk about human rights, because we're really concerned that an agreement on climate change, of course, we're here pushing for an agreement that will actually make a difference on the ground. And some of the states, like the United States, countries are settling for working towards an agreement to have no more than 2 degrees centigrade temperature increase globally. But many scientists, including the UN scientists, have said that degree of temperature rise will have a devastating impact on the traditional lifeways and ecosystems of Indigenous people in many places, not just the Arctic and island communities, but everywhere. So we're joining with over 100 countries here, including, of course, the small island states, in trying to keep an agreement to a temperature rise of no more than 1.5 degrees centigrade. And that makes a huge difference. If we're talking about looking globally at, you know, places like where I'm from, you know, the Sonora Desert in Arizona and northern Mexico, you know, which is experiencing drought, and corn isn't growing like it used to, and tornadoes in the United States and Oklahoma, you know, the increase of tornadoes and forest fires in California and British Columbia. Salmon are dying at unprecedented rates, and they're not expected even to survive beyond the end of the century in central California, the Coho Salmon Run, because of the warming temperatures. So, you know, this is all over the planet that we're talking about.
All right, let me jump in there, Andrea. You're listening to Flashpoints, and we're hearing from Andrea Garman. She's the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council. She's part of a delegation. She's there in Paris now. And that was a beautiful overview. I did note that you were disappointed regarding the President of the United States and the, I guess, the lack to his lack of recognizing the importance it is, when you think about this issue, the importance of considering the indigenous communities. Now, I want you to, if you could, go down the line, name some of the key issues and how they are already directly impacting on indigenous communities who are losing their lands from Canada to all the way down the coast to the end of Chile. Could you talk about some of the key issues and the impact being faced right now by the indigenous communities?
Well, we're experiencing impact right here. You know, the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples that was adopted by the UN General Assembly in 2007, and of course the US was the last country to come on board in 2010 to support it, but nevertheless they have said that indigenous peoples have the right to participate in decision-making that would affect our rights. But the negotiating sessions here on the different parts of the text, we're not even able to come into the room as observers to listen. We have to, some of the indigenous peoples from the Pacific, and we have one from Canada, have managed to get credentialed by those countries, so they're in there and can report out to us. But, you know, first and foremost, we are not at the table to participate in the negotiations of text and decisions which will dramatically affect our rights. So our rights are being violated right here at COP21, and that's something that we're taking note of. But nevertheless, we are talking to the countries. I probably talked to at least 20 today, everything from New Zealand to Ecuador to Iraq, I mean, the whole gamut of the states, United States, of course, we're talking to in Canada, and about their position to include phrasing that says respect, promote, protect, and fulfill human rights, including the rights of indigenous peoples, that will be a fundamental principle in how this agreement will be carried out. Because we know as indigenous peoples that a lot of our land is still protected, is still pristine, is the ecosystems are healthy because we protected it. But yet when they talk about adaptation and mitigation, you know, our land, our water, our resources will be a target for use by the states as they look for ways to try to resolve the problems that they've created around climate change. So we want to make sure that our rights to land, to our traditional economies and subsistence, free, prior, informed consent, as well as traditional knowledge and the way we can contribute to these discussions and trying to solve some of these problems using our traditional understanding of relationships with the earth, our original seeds, you know, our practices which have not contributed to climate change, that we have something to offer these discussions as well. And our traditional knowledge needs to be protected and respected. So these are actually some elements in the text that we're working on making sure are included. It's an uphill battle in some ways. Actually, I will say the United States today, because of a lot of pressure from indigenous peoples and also other organizations that are here, and Canada and some of the others are beginning to look at supporting that language, not in the operative like we want it, but maybe in the preamble, which we're still fighting it for it to be included in the operative. But human rights in general, you know, gender equity, intergenerational equity, you know, youth and elders. We're also supporting other provisions that some other constituencies are bringing, and they're supporting rights of indigenous peoples as, you know, we can work on mutually agreed on language that can take everybody's concerns into consideration. But we have countries here that don't want human rights at all in the document.
All right, well, let's talk again. I would love to to really get the human face on this. These are struggles that are crucial to Indigenous peoples. There are frontline issues unfolding all over the world. I would really love it if you could give us some more specifics in terms of what the battlefront is, what the issues, where are people on the front line struggling. We hear a lot about communities of color and incredible suffering around environmental racism. Help us keep a human face on this.
Well, one of the big areas that we're really emphasizing is what Indigenous peoples call food sovereignty or right to food. And we're hearing not just from our communities that can't grow our traditional corn anymore because of the climate changes and lack of rainfall to Indigenous peoples along the salmon areas, along the Pacific coast that are coming to say there was like an 80% salmon die-off on the Columbia River, the Coho Salmon Run, this year because of the warming water temperatures. You know, these are real issues that affect, you know, Indigenous people's lives, their cultures, their ceremonial ways of life.
And by the way, we should note that's the Columbia River that wraps right around the Hanford nuclear facility, which is a disaster waiting, continuing to happen and really affecting, as you say, Indigenous communities, correct?
That's right. No doubt. And then the dams that are there, you know, have already affected the salmon run. So this is one more thing. In addition, with a very struggling species, that salmon is like an indicator species. We heard from some Indigenous peoples on our delegation from the Great Lakes area how wild rice is diminishing that they live from and is a fundamental part of their culture. We're hearing from Indigenous peoples in Alaska that, you know, they're just not able to hunt seals and walruses and the things they've always lived off of. And these are isolated communities. They don't have another resource to turn to. And this is part of their culture as well. So for Indigenous peoples, our relationship with our traditional food is not just economic and nutrition. It's our identity. You know, our spiritual and clan relationships and all of those things are included. And we're hearing people, we're giving people a chance to talk about that. We have Indigenous peoples from Canada that are directly affected by the tar sands. And we had an elder speak about the victory that we just all had, you know, for the defeat by the Obama administration. And we have to give him great credit for that, you know, for standing up for what was right against, you know, political opposition to deny the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline that would bring that filthy oil down from the tar sands, which is devastating, and in communities up in Alberta, Canada, down to the middle of the United States, just waiting for a spill. So this is really a sign of important solidarity between Indigenous nations in U.S. and Canada that we were able to present yesterday with some videos. We have an Indigenous pavilion here, and we had the opening with North America Day, and it was packed, standing room only, as people from the community as well as delegates from the countries were listening to Indigenous peoples tell their stories. And we started with a panel of traditional elders talking about traditional knowledge about climate change, how this has been prophesized, how this has been predicted if we continue to misuse the natural resources of the earth. So we feel like we have a lot to contribute here.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Andrea Carmen. She's executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council. She is in Paris now, and she is working with many communities with the International Treaty Council and many other communities across the region, the hemisphere, and around the world. And I want to take you back to Canada for a moment, because I'm not sure people understand that there are communities now, there are Indigenous communities that have already lost their land, right? This isn't a philosophical issue. This isn't a debate. This isn't something that's going to happen in the future. It's happening now, right? I imagine you heard some of those stories.
It's absolutely happening now. And the relationship between what Indigenous peoples are going through on the ground with mega projects like the tar sand in the far north areas of Alberta, Canada, which used to be, you know, forests and rivers and clean water, which are now just devastated there and contaminated. But that project alone, the tar sands in Canada, produces more greenhouse gases that cause climate change than all of the other sources in Canada, all the cars, all the buses and planes and all the factories. So what Indigenous peoples are defending with their homeland struggles on the ground is also a major part of fighting global climate change. We heard from representatives from the Navajo, Dene Nation too, in Arizona about the fight against coal mining there. And that's also a fight against global warming because, of course, burning fossil fuels is the biggest cause. That's, you know, fracking. We heard about, you know, some of the impacts of fracking in Oklahoma, all the earthquakes and devastation of water supplies.
A record number of earthquakes. Yeah, they're breaking all records in terms of earthquakes.
Exactly.
It's an extraordinary thing. And just a few more specifics about the fight, you know, this fight against the coal miners and the digging up the earth and the impact on Indigenous communities. This isn't a new story, but this has become a battlefront in this context of climate change and global warming, correct?
Absolutely. You know, one of the big struggles here is the biggest single emitter of greenhouse gases, mainly from burning coal, is China. And where does that come from? A lot of it comes from Indigenous lands, you know, in the Americas, you know, and other places. So that the big debate is what is the responsibility of the different countries? They call it differentiated responsibilities. The small countries, Africa, I heard today, maybe produces 7% in total of the world greenhouse gases, you know, and they're demanding that countries like the United States that and Barack Obama did recognize that the United States has been a major contributor to climate change. It has still the largest output per capita. And so, of course, that gets back to, you know, demanding a change in energy policy, but also each of us looking at our, what they say, carbon footprint. You know, what do we use that maybe we could cut back on? And so, but the debate over, you know, China as still considered a developing country, you know, should they need to cut back as well? And that's something the U.S. is really pushing for, too. So it's really an interesting debate, and they're still just talking about economics, a lot of the countries. And we're talking about survival of Indigenous peoples, not just in the future, but now in many places. And that's what it's coming down to is, you know, kind of a political and economic debate among countries is who's to blame, who has to do more, and all of that. Where we're sitting here saying, well, we're, you know, being killed off literally by this climate crisis and the causes of the climate crisis, the fossil fuel extraction.
We don't often think about, for instance, groups like the United Farm Workers as being on the cutting edge of standing against environmental racism. But in terms of pesticides and deadly chemicals that are used on the land that people of color and Indigenous communities are exposed to, this has been a long time battle, and it's a worker struggle as well, correct?
Absolutely, and it's a human rights struggle as well because this has been a battle that we've been fighting in our Yaqui communities in northern Mexico. We just took the case against Mexico for importing the pesticides that are being exported by the United States. We've also taken the United States to the United Nations on this because they're the biggest exporter of pesticides that they themselves banned for use in the United States. And they ship it to Mexico and Guatemala and spray it in airplanes over schools and communities. And we actually documented 39 cases of children that have died from direct exposure to these pesticides in small Yaqui communities in northern Mexico. And we were able to get the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child to declare that environmental health was a human right that all children have, as well as related to maternal health and it related to the pesticides. And definitely there's a strong connection between that kind of chemical contamination of indigenous and farming communities and what's happening also, you know, with climate change, both in cause and the effect, because a lot of these insects are now moving further and further north. And we have documented over 38,000 acres of forests that have been killed by bark beetles that are invading forests all the way from Alaska, British Columbia, California, Montana, and that's a direct impact of climate change. But, of course, the industrial solution is to spray pesticides on that. So, you know, this is a growing problem, and I'm glad you mentioned it because it is strongly connected. You know, here, though, many things are connected to climate change that we're just really starting to think about and talk about.
Well, let me ask you this. We're running out of time, and we're delighted, Andrea, to have you with us from Paris, working with many Indigenous communities, working, of course, representing as the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council. But you're there right in the middle. So maybe you could, if you had a chance to really sit down with the people who are calling the shots there, if they weren't trying their best to exclude indigenous communities and sort of, I guess, you know, try and hold you at bay as they do whatever they want to do to represent the 1%, what's your best shot? If you were sitting down with the key leaders, what does your speech sound like?
My speech would be that we all have children and grandchildren, or will someday. We have nieces and nephews. We have children in our community. And to really think about their lives and what it's going to be for them in 25 years if the situation isn't radically changed, not just a little bit changed, but a radical withdrawal of the fossil fuel-based economy to a sustainable way of life. You know, what is their life going to be? And they're going to look back on this body, on all of us, the countries, all of us who are here, and they're going to say, what did you do? You knew what was happening. Everyone knew what was happening. What did you do for us here in Paris? You know, what are you going to do, you know, to put whatever comes out of here into action on the ground, and that'll make a difference for the future? I think we have to appeal to the heart and the souls of the countries that are here, the heads of state, you know, the state negotiators, so that we all realize, you know, that we all live on the same planet. And yeah, like I said, you know, our future generations are going to be the ones that look back and judge us, you know, to see what we did so that they could have a life that was just and livable, and where they could thrive and the natural world could thrive as well. So that's what we're talking about. When we actually, you know, have a lot of opportunity to interact with the countries, with the states, and, you know, present our positions to them. We may not be in the room, but we catch them when they come out, before they go in. We go to their offices and talk to them. And it's something that we can talk, you know, as a human family about. And the other message is that Indigenous peoples have a lot to offer to this dialogue, not just addressing the causes, but providing solutions based on our traditional knowledge and our practices and the use of how we've maintained our relationship, you know, with our Mother Earth and the natural world. And we want to offer those solutions because all of our lives are at stake, and especially our children and grandchildren. So those are the messages that we're bringing here. And I think we're making an impact, and we'll see what'll happen. The negotiations on the text are supposed to be done tomorrow. And then the presidency of the Conference of the Parties, who is France in this case, is going to supposedly bring a text next week ready for the heads of state to adopt. So we only have another 24 hours probably to impact the text. So we ask for thoughts and prayers from everybody, and you know, we're all in this fight together.
All right, Andrea Carmen, joining us from Paris, France, Executive Director of the International Indian Treaty Council there, working with Indigenous communities, Native peoples from around the Americas and around the world. We, again, thank you for joining us on Flashpoints, and we'll talk to you when you get back and see what happened.
Thank you for asking me. Let's wait to see. A week from Friday, we should have a legally binding agreement. Let's see if they can do it. Let's see. Okay?
We'll see what happens. Thanks so much. Be careful. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. We return for part two of a talk by Lance DeHaven Smith on SCADs, State Crimes Against Democracy. He thinks that SCAD is a more useful term than conspiracy theory. The CIA cooked up the term conspiracy theory to mock and marginalize critics of the Warren Commission report. Plus, the term SCADs puts the emphasis on crime. We can't prevent the elite from conspiring, but we can detect, prove, and punish crime. Let's do it. This talk is wide-ranging, loosely structured, and full of fascinating details of SCADs past and present. Time is short, so we'll jump back in. Lance DeHaven Smith.
There's a very important false premise that we have like a free press in this country that's aggressive and that is, just can't wait to expose these kind of things. And if you just go to them and show them the evidence, they'll run right over to the cameras. And
you're absolutely correct. There's an article by Cass Sunstein. His wife is Samantha Power, the new UN person. Oh, God. He said exactly what you said. He said the newspapers, that, you know, it would come out. People would sell it. You know, if you knew there was one of these big conspiracies, you'd go to the media and sell your story. You know, what's his evidence for this? And he says, well, like, we found out about the warrantless wiretaps that the Bush administration was doing. Well, yeah, we found out about them, but it was only 2 years after the 2004 election. They knew about it at the New York Times and held that until after the election and would never have told us, except one of their reporters, James Ryson, was publishing a book in 2005 that had this in there, that they had done these warrantless wiretaps. So I think that's a very good point, and you're absolutely correct. There's the assumption that the press would talk, and in reality, the press is the big gatekeeper of all this stuff. So why do we use the term conspiracy theory? I mean, if it's so stupid and un-American and nonsensical and befuddling, why do we use it? Well, it turns out that the term was popularized by the Central Intelligence Agency in response to the critics of the Warren Commission. In 1967, the Central Office of the CIA sent a memo to all its stations around the world telling them to contact their media assets and tell them if they come across people criticizing the Warren Commission report to call them conspiracy theorists, say there's no evidence of a conspiracy, say that if there had been a conspiracy, somebody would have talked, the newspapers would have uncovered it. It's all the things we hear today about conspiracy theory, the criticisms of it, were in this memo. In my book, I replicate the memo in the appendix. This was reported in the New York Times in 1976 when the memo was declassified, and mistakenly declassified. It was in the news one day, and that was it. Well, they also said they said you should tell people who are labeling people conspiracy theorists, they should say that the conspiracy theorist is under the sway of communist propagandists. So the idea was if you talked about Kennedy being assassinated by one of our people, that it was something the communists were pushing on us. And it was applied to the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, Wallace. When Robert Kennedy was assassinated, the night he was assassinated, the police are radioing. They were chasing people who they thought might have been involved in it. One of them was this woman that wore the polka dot dress. This is kind of an arcane point. But what's interesting is the police say on the radio, don't chase this person. We don't want another conspiracy theory. So they're already using this term by 1968 and being concerned about it. One of the things I'm trying to do is develop a forensic science for tracking these memes, because that's what the government's doing. And we realize that. We know that they, you know, when they devise a war plan, they'll think up some term like Operation Iraqi Liberation. Oh, no, that was oil. Operation Iraqi Freedom. We know they do that. But I don't think we realize that they're doing it secretly and inserting these memes into our public discourse. Yes, sir.
Yeah. What was the very first reference you found in use?
The term conspiracy theory had come up in a book by Charles and Mary Beard in 1913. It was called The Conspiracy Theory of the 14th Amendment, and it was written about in academic. It wasn't popular. You can't find it in the newspapers. And there was a letter to an editor around 1935 complaining about the conspiracy mentality. And there was a story in like 1963 that was before the Kennedy assassination that was about the conspiracy mindset. So you pick up a little thing, but what you don't see is it being used 25, 30 times. The main problem we have that has influenced our thinking with the conspiracy theory label is it causes us to look at these events as isolated events. Like we have conspiracy theories of Kennedy, of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, but we don't have conspiracy theories of assassinations. We don't look at them together. If I say Kennedy assassination, I'm talking about President Kennedy. Nobody ever uses the term Kennedy assassinations, plural. But those were connected conspiracies, obviously. John Kennedy was running for president. His brother was running for president. When does his brother get killed? His brother gets killed on the night he wins the Democratic primary in California. Okay, so there's obvious connections, and yet we don't say Kennedy assassinations. We don't say 9/11 anthrax. The anthrax occurred immediately after 9/11. It shaped the way we saw it. 9/11 was scary, but it was just in New York. The anthrax could have hit anybody, anywhere. It was very frightening. And yet we separate those in our minds. The term conspiracy, if you have multiple conspiracies, that's called organized crime or serial crime. And we should use that term instead of conspiracy. But it causes us to look at events in isolation. 2000 and the 2004 elections, those were almost identical in terms of the sabotage that was done. Making it difficult for minorities to register, putting too few machines in the urban Democratic stronghold so the lines were real long and people would get discouraged and go away. There were computer anomalies. In Florida, the exit polls showed Gore winning by 3 percentage points. And when the voting returns came back, it was Bush at 500 votes more. Same in Ohio. The exit polls showed Kerry winning by 2 or 3 points. And then when they count the votes, well, that should tell you something. I call it incident-specific myopia. And I point out to people that this is the opposite of the way we view ordinary crimes. If a husband marries a man marries a wealthy woman and she falls in the shower and is killed, and he inherits a bunch of money, we're automatically suspicious because it's an improbable event and he benefited. If he then marries another wealthy woman and she falls and hurts or gets killed in a similar accident, we're convinced that this is a plot. I mean, our minds are automatically suspicious. What happened, what they've done, and this is the way these memes work, they're normal, rational processes. when you see things occur, you tend to look at a pattern and you suspect things. And what the conspiracy theory meme is doing is breaking down that rational process. You're not supposed to think about connected crimes. You're not supposed to suspect these people. And so you look at them one by one and you miss the connections between them. This is a Cass Sunstein article. I may have mentioned it. He is advocating that people who are in conspiracy theory groups online, me and my friends, I guess is who he's talking about, that they should be cognitively disrupted. What I think he means is that they're planting trolls, they're sometimes called, people to get on these online conversations and introduce arguments and ideas that are disruptive and make it very difficult for people to coalesce and strategize constructively about that. I mean, it is breathtaking hypocrisy that what he's proposing. And this is a guy who was head of information, the Office of Information in the Obama administration until recently. What he's saying is we're going to conspire to stop people from saying the government conspires. It's unbelievable. I mean, these people are twisted, deeply twisted. Yeah, I call it linguistic thought control. I think we have to have a name for this stuff, subliminal indoctrination. Sounds kind of paranoid, but if they're doublespeak, yes. Yeah, I went back and read 1984, and he has an appendix in that book that talks about the language and how they were, he thought that they were taking out the emotions out of language and using all these acronyms that shaped your thinking and left you unable to connect your own life to what was going on. I just have a list of 18, 20 SCADs. We've talked about most of these. I include McCarthyism, Oswald, 68 October Surprise, Ellsberg, the attempted assassination of George Wallace. Wallace was running as a third-party candidate. He had the potential to draw away votes from Nixon. Ross Perot, when he ran, he got 20% of the votes nationally, but he took those votes from Bush, and Bush lost to Clinton. So this was a real fear. Wallace said that Nixon was behind it. He went to the FBI and complained about it. He said, how could this guy be stalking me? Where did he get the weapon? He was staying in expensive hotels. I didn't know my schedule. You know, it just doesn't make sense. Somebody had to be helping him. Watergate, we've discussed. The attempt on Reagan is a little less clear, but I'll show you some stuff that might surprise you.
Why do you suppose they go for Reagan?
Reagan got shot 3 months after he was in office. And the person who shot him, this guy Hinckley, Bush was asked about Hinckley. Did he know him? Had he ever heard of him? He said, no, I don't know anything about these people. I've never heard of him. I have no connection to him. Well, it turns out the Hinckley family had been donating money to his campaigns, lots of money, big money. And then it turned out that one of the Bush sons,
Neil,
was having dinner with Hinckley's brother the night after the assassination. And you see connections like that, and it's very troubling. It's very troubling. So I include this as a low probability, but I would still consider it. Wellstone I have in here, he was killed in a plane crash when the Senate was evenly divided and debating about going to war in Iraq. I tell my students, do not fly on airplanes with U.S. senators when the Senate is evenly divided. Okay? It's a big risk. There's practical implications to my theories and research. Iraq, 2004. The bogus terror alerts were when they would raise the thing from yellow to orange. Every time Bush's support would go down, there'd be a terror alert. And that's a manipulation. If you just look at the confirmation, most of these are well confirmed. Maybe not officially, but many officially. A few are not so well confirmed, but still are awfully suspicious, including 9/11. And then the low confirmation are the ones that we just haven't gotten confessions. We haven't gotten people talking. We haven't gotten, you know, forensic evidence, medical evidence, and that kind of thing. People who do these kinds of crimes, most of them are lawyers. They know the law. They know it very carefully, and they know what they can do with evidence and so on. They've sworn these secrecy oaths. Ellsberg said that the oath that they swear means that even if they're in Congress and they're asked something, they can't say that they know something, that it overrides their sworn oath to Congress. Compartmentalization, conflicts of interest, we know about that. And then, of course, if worse comes to worse, when we've finally got them pinned down, they pardon everybody who might testify against them. They tend to cluster around elections. So the 64 election, the 68 election, 72 election, the 80, 2000, 2004. So when you have a presidential election, be on the lookout for these things. If you look at what are the most common modus operandi, I'm trying to use this criminological lingo because I find it helpful. The most common is assassinations, and I'm counting these as six, and Lane and Daschle, the Senate leaders who received the anthrax letters, I don't include in this six, so it would be eight if you included that. So that's a very common one, and it's an old historic political crime. You got somebody that you're competing with, kill them. Manipulation of foreign events to stir up fear and warmongering is almost as common as assassination. And that's another one that is the language speaks to us about false flag operations and provocations, agents provocateur, that kind of thing. Provocations, the election tampering, and then the burglary. The black bag job is something that they do, but they do, it's more likely they do that to us as opposed to a very high leader. But the most common ones use the skills and tactics of the military and intelligence. It's a signature, in effect. If you look at the confirmation in terms, so these are the high confirmation, the medium, and the low. And if you look at what they are, the things that we don't learn about are assassinations. They're very hard. People don't confess to murder. It's really hard to get that out. They will confess to the... McNamara confessed that they knew the Gulf of Tonkin was bogus. He said this on a film. So they'll confess to things like that, but they won't confess to treason and assassination. It's hard to get that information out. And I think that that's the attitude we should have. When we see an assassination, we should realize that it's going to be very hard for us to uncover this. We should be very skeptical about what the government says, and we should be insisting on a thorough investigation. Most of the time these are done for the benefit of military activities, either start a war, prolong a war, create fear of a war. And there are some that are just political opportunism. You know, Nixon was a murderer, and Johnson was. This has come out recently that he had a hired killer that worked for him in Texas. And when you're running against people like that, you know, you likely, think about it. Basically, everybody that ran against Nixon got killed. Okay? John Kennedy beat Nixon in 1960. He gets assassinated in 63. Robert Kennedy is running against him in 1968 and would have won if he lived. He gets whacked. And George Wallace is running against him in 72, and he gets killed or crippled. You know, if you saw that in an ordinary crime, you'd be saying, well, this is obvious. We should be talking to Nixon. Let's find out where this guy was. What did his friends say? Let's talk to his underlings. Let's promise them if they'll confess that we'll give them a good deal. Any ordinary guy, that's what would happen to him. President of the United States, forget it.
It's not illegal if the president does it.
Yeah, that's what their attitude is. That's what Nixon said. If you look at the assassination targets, it's only presidents. It's not vice presidents, and senators and presidents. It's not the Supreme Court. I don't want to put any thoughts in anybody's head. But the Supreme Court justices, they don't have protection. They go jogging down in Washington. They have enormous power. People say, well, people don't know who they were. Let me tell you, when I was growing up, there were signs all over the South that said, impeach Earl Warren. Literally. Literally. People knew who Earl Warren was in the South. No House member since Gabrielle, or until Gabrielle, and there's no evidence to suggest that that was any kind of scan. But, you know, there are a lot of House members. I was in Washington about 6 months ago, was walking around Congress, and Ron Paul came walking by. And I saw her, I said, boy, I just really, you inspire me. I think it's great, the things you do. But I thought, and he said thanks and walked on, and I thought, hell, I could have killed him right there. I mean, I wouldn't have done it. I don't want you to get that. But, because I like him, at least. But, I mean, the point was, he had no protection. He was just out in the open, and there were no gun screens or anything. There was nothing to prevent people from being around him with weapons. So it's bizarre that it's the president. that gets targeted. The one thing about the presidents, they only get shot when you've got a very different vice president. Like Johnson was a real hawk when Kennedy was a dove. George H.W. Bush was a CIA-connected guy when Reagan was more of an isolationist in some ways. And I think the Bushes figured this out, actually. When George H.W. Bush appointed Dan Quayle as his VP, sort of assassination insurance. Nixon actually said when Ford got appointed vice president, he said, uh-oh, I am really worried now. I wasn't worried before when had Agnew, because they weren't going to impeach me and have Agnew president. But now Ford is vice president, I'm in trouble. So they think about this. They're increasing, and they tend to occur around particular administrations. The Bush people are really very suspect. I think we should be very, very cautious about them. There have been a lot of crimes committed while members of their family were in office. And Jeb Bush may run, so. And Kennedy, Robert Kennedy Jr., came out about 6 months ago and said that he thought it was a conspiracy and that Douglas's book, The Unspeakable, was a good account of it. The Kennedys have never spoken about this. And, you know, people say, well, why? I mean, why would they not speak out? For one thing, they're afraid of getting killed, which is a reasonable fear. But the other thing is there's the elites. This is like the worst taboo. If you speak ill of a fellow elite, it's just a terrible thing. So I think they think of protecting their class interest as more important.
When your articles are rejected by official magazines and publications, why not go to somewhere like Mother Jones, the Progressive, some of the other really good alternative media out there? It was Mother Jones who exposed the Romney comment before the last...
Do you know what? I've tried to publish in the New York Times. I did get this article in the Guardian. But frankly, my perception is that the left will go all the way up to, but they won't step over the line where we talk about crime. I mean, and we can talk about scandal. We can talk about immoral behavior. But when we talk about crime, that these people are murderers, these people are traitors, these people are embezzlers, you know, we can't talk. We can't say that. That's just too much. It's too much because it implies an action in response. If our leaders are murderers, we can't just sit back. If they're unscrupulous, well, that's okay. If you're, you know, having an affair with the intern, well, that's okay.
I would like to hear your interpretation of why Ronald Reagan chose George H.W. Bush as his vice president.
The story is that Rockefeller went to him and said, you got to do it. This is our guy. They said in the CIA, Bush had been in the CIA, and they said when the campaign posters were put up surreptitiously in the CIA, there'd be a campaign poster for Reagan Bush. But they would always tear it and take Reagan out. And it was just, but look, they named the building after Bush, the CIA headquarters building. They say he protected them during the Church Commission hearings and all that. I mean, if we saw the Soviet Union, the head of the KGB, become the head of the Soviet Union, which is what we saw with Putin, basically becomes the head of Russia, I mean, we'd automatically think, well, this guy's connected. This guy's going to be a gangster of sorts. But we haven't said that about our own system. The Syria is a SCAD, if we go into that. Libya, in a way, is a SCAD. It was a violation of international law. It subverted the democratic process because Obama got a tortured Office of Legal Counsel memo saying it wasn't an act of war. So he knew what he was doing. He was subverting it. Uncertain, the Boston Marathon bombing. I was looking for a connection. There was a peculiar thing that did happen, and that was there were ricin letters that were mailed in Alabama or somewhere. And it occurred right with this. And so I got to thinking, well, you know, this is very similar to 9/11, where you have this bombing terrorist attack and then the biological attack. And I got to thinking, well, maybe it was a booster shot, you know, from the higher ups. They thought, you know, we needed a little jolt. They didn't want to do a full-blown nuclear attack or something like that, dirty nuclear bomb somewhere, really get us freaked. But they felt like they needed to I know it sounds very paranoid, but that's what I... If you go back and read NSC 68 and you realize that the government doesn't trust you, the government thinks you are a liability in their effort to maintain your freedom, your viability. Once you realize that, you have to understand they see this as a responsibility to take care of us, and that may mean sacrificing us at times.
Behind all of this, these scares, appears to be a huge profit motive. And don't we see the banks,
yes,
who make their highest profit by far funding war and defense contractors,
yes,
and these are the people at the apex of these crimes.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a war machine, and it's a financial machine. I have a friend in Australia that writes about economic scads. They're state crimes that are anti-democratic, but their motive is profit. Yes, there's an economic component. To some extent, I try to stay on the crimes and get the empirical evidence, and then abstract away from that to consider what's the nature of the criminal. And what I'm seeing is all the crimes, or very many of them, are related to war and militarism, and certainly they benefit the armaments companies and to some extent the banks as well. Part of what I'm trying to do is create a foundation of work and forensic methods. I think of it as SCAD detectives. We're like Sherlock Holmes for the 21st century. That we're trying to figure out how do we investigate these people. Observation methods for SCAD detection, for state crime detection. And for example, after every election, we should have an audit of the ballots against the exit polls. If we can't do that, we should at least have the statisticians look at it. They've got techniques now where they can tell when the numbers are made up, and there are certain patterns to look for. And if the government won't do it for us, we're going to have to do it for ourselves. And that's pretty much what's been happening. After 2004, Steve Freeman, a statistician at the University of Pennsylvania, looked at all the exit polls and the election returns and compared them and found that 10 out of 11 battleground states had statistically improbable deviations of the returns from the exit polls, and they always favored Bush. And he calculated the probability of that, given the difference between the exit poll and the returns and the sample sizes, and he said the odds of that happening by chance were like a zillion to one. But we need methods like that. Yes, sir, here you.
Well, we privatized the election counters and the contract went out.
It's unbelievable.
The software is private property?
Yes, it's unbelievable. And why we would put our elections in the hands of people that even if they're angels, why we would do that, it just makes no sense. I was when the Orange Revolution occurred in the Ukraine, one of their candidates who eventually wins the presidency was poisoned with something that made his face real bad. I don't know if you remember that. And they were interviewing his campaign manager right before the election, and they said, well, you know, do you have any worries about the election? He says, yeah, I'm worried about keeping my guy alive. And, you know, they said, well, really? He said, well, yeah, think about it. We're talking billions of dollars in government contracts and policy affecting, you know, all kinds of things. You think the stakes are not enormously high? People wouldn't do something like that? Well, think about the United States elections. Huge financial implications, huge ideological implications. And then we're going to set it up where we have voting machines with no paper trail that are vulnerable to hacking, and that you can actually plant programs in the machines that switch votes between candidates and then erase themselves at the end of the day.
Here we must end part two of Lance DeHaven Smith's intriguing talk on SCADs, State Crimes Against Democracy. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and inviting you to tune in again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear an interview with architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I've asked Richard Gage, AIA, to join me on the show to share his wisdom with us once again, and because he's doing a tour of New England this month, November 2015, it's a 12-city tour, and one of those stops will be in Torrington, Connecticut. So let's begin with the interview. Richard Gage, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Tell me, for people who don't know, who is Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and what are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, we are a nonprofit organization of 2,350 verified, and many more yet to be verified, architects and engineers who are calling for a new investigation of the destruction of the World Trade Center towers on 9/11. And we are quite concerned about the official reports put out by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We are quite concerned that most architects and engineers and everybody else almost knows nothing about the third worst structural collapse on 9/11. That is World Trade Center Building 7, which I'm looking forward to sharing with you and your listeners. And that this building is a key smoking gun that shows that we have not been told the truth about 9/11 and the catastrophic events, particularly at the World Trade Center.
And why is it important for us to have the truth about what happened on 9/11? What drives you to do what you do?
Well, I don't want to be living in a country that lies to its people about something so incredibly important as these events. After all, they started two major wars in which over a couple of million people had been killed, including more than 6,000, 7,000 now U.S. soldiers. And we've lost our liberties. Our civil liberties have been legislated away and taken through executive order as well. The Military Commissions Act, the Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, where any of us, you, me, your listeners, can be arrested without even told what we're charged with. Merely being associated with terrorism, we can be held without a right to a lawyer, a trial, a jury. So we can be held indefinitely, even tortured and assassinated. This is not okay. Our forefathers fought for our freedoms, and particularly in the Northeast, and where we're going to be having this exciting tour coming up. And then we just sacrifice our freedom for security. And we've been warned that we deserve neither if we do that by our forefathers.
Right. And even when we do give up our freedoms for this supposed security, it hasn't given us more security, but much less security, with an all-powerful executive branch of government and our Constitution, which has been basically thrown out the window. And that brings us back to the government. And I know you said that the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, was charged with investigating how the towers and World Trade Center 7 fell. Can you tell us what their data is or what they're saying happened and then what the evidence shows that in the research that you've done?
Well, sure. And we have two different reports from them. One is about the Twin Towers and one is about World Trade Center 7. each of them are full of obfuscation, misinformation, disinformation, and complete avoiding of much of the evidence that was found. Which one would you like to start with, though, Cheryl?
Well, why don't we do World Trade Center 7, since most people don't even know about that one?
Sure. So we'll first introduce then that building to the listeners that may not have heard about it, which is just shocking. Here's the third worst structural failure in modern history, and most architects don't even know about it. So it's a 47-story skyscraper about a football field in length away from the Twin Towers. It wasn't hit by an airplane, but in the afternoon, about 7 hours after the towers came down, the Twin Towers, this building, after witnesses hear explosions, it drops suddenly, symmetrically, straight down, uniformly into its own footprint almost, in the exact manner of a classic controlled demolition. You know, it falls in under 7 seconds, and that's at free fall acceleration, meaning that no resistance was given by any of the 80 columns on each floor of this building, meaning that they had to have been removed. Of course, that can only be done by explosives. And it looks exactly like a classic implosion. So our problem with the NIST report is that first they lie about how fast it came down. They said at first it came down at 40% of free fall acceleration. Then when challenged publicly, they acknowledged that, in fact, it was free fall, but they do not acknowledge the implications of this. Second, they blame fires, normal office fires. This is incredible because normal office fires have never brought down any skyscraper ever. It's unprecedented. And so NIST should have been looking at the obvious, the hypothesis, which is explosive controlled demolition, instead of by fires, which have no previous history at all of bringing a skyscraper down, especially since it looks exactly like a controlled demolition.
Did NIST look at all for controlled demolition?
No. In fact, NIST was chartered with all three of these buildings. With respect to the Twin Towers, their charter from Congress was to examine the evidence for the destruction by fire. And I think that may be true for Building 7. I've got to double check that, which is incredible because it completely biases their outcome, of course, which is exactly what happened. There is no evidence here for destruction by fire. So what do? They manufacture it. They have a collapse initiation scenario in which they theorize that massive fires on the 12th floor cause long span beams to expand, thermally expand, pushing a girder off of its seat, causing floor 13 to fall on 12, 12 on 10, and so on for 9 floors. And then what they say is that column 79 buckles. Then within a total of about 20 seconds, the entire building caves in from the inside and the overall building comes down then in the manner we saw. It is so ludicrous from so many perspectives, starting with the fact that those fires on that floor were out over an hour before the building ever came down. And so they completely hoodwinked the profession, because they put out this massive report of 1,000 pages 8 years later. But they did not seek peer review of it. They will not release the computer input data, citing that that would jeopardize public safety if we were to give out this information to architects and engineers who are, in fact, tasked with ensuring the public safety.
So their report is completely nonsensical. I mean, it makes no sense.
No, a whole bunch of things don't make sense about what NIST has done.
So you go around, I know, to a lot of architectural conventions and things and talk to other architects, and you're saying that the vast majority of them don't know what's going on. And then when you do show them the research that your group has done, do they usually change their mind?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. We went to during our Southwest tour, which we completed about 3 weeks ago, we had the opportunity to have a booth in front of 400 structural engineers at the conference in Las Vegas. And we were able to speak personally with 100 of them. We gave out at least 100 DVDs and booklets. Our new booklet, Beyond Misinformation, is a very powerful indictment against NIST, with 50 pages of evidence for the explosive demolition of these towers and why the NIST report makes no sense. And that booklet was of great interest to the structural engineers. We were able to sign up 25 of the 100 we spoke to on the spot to our petition, joining the 2,300 2,700 total architects and engineers demanding a new investigation. So that was pretty remarkable. We're going to attempt to reach 10,000 architects with 36 volunteers in Boston on November 17th through the 19th at the ABX Boston Architectural Convention, where we'll have a 20-foot-long booth to attract these architects with three large screens hitting every direction.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, because we have a peninsula-style booth, so it's going to show Building 7 coming down over and over again every 10 seconds.
Yeah, that's a good one, because if you look at that, it just looks so like a controlled demolition. I mean, there's no doubt after you look at that a few times.
And for listeners who haven't seen the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, I encourage you to check it out at Richard's website, which is ae911truth.org, and the Twin Towers while you're there also. But you can see that all three look like controlled demolition. Then again, it's ae911truth.org. Richard, you mentioned your new booklet, Beyond Misinformation, and we gave that away as a premium during our fund drive last week, and it'll be available at all of these stops on the New England tour, including the one in Torrington, Connecticut on Saturday, November 14th. And if you can't make it out to Torrington, Connecticut on November 14th, or to one of the other stops on the tour, you can get a copy of the booklet on the website, ae911truth.org. It's a really great resource for the scientific evidence and photos of the three World Trade Center towers and what really happened to make them explode and collapse.
Richard, is there anything else you want to say about the booklet? I know it's coming out in hard copy soon, correct?
Oh, yes. It's pretty exciting. It's a harder copy. It's a card stock in a book form as opposed to a magazine form. And it will have on the back cover a flap for the inclusion of our milestone DVD documentary, 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. And so this is a powerful package where people can actually see the film and have the booklet also. We'll be continuing to get that into the hands of VIPs, and it's something that activists can really use as a powerful tool to wake up politicians, other architects and engineers, and media representatives. We're very excited about that, and it's going in the libraries as well, thousands of libraries.
Yeah, how can people tie into that library program?
Oh, yeah, there's a donation button on our website for that program, and that is ae911truth.org. That's ae911truth.org. We do need lots of support from people who care about this issue and recognize the implications of these controlled demolitions. We're not just talking about building failures here. We're talking about the controlled demolition of our democratic way of life if we can be lied to. If such an incredible situation can start $4.5 trillion global war on terror, enriching the media corporations, the arms industry, the oil industry, the banking industry, all of whom profited enormously from 9/11 and control the message through just six corporations who seem to own and operate the messaging capability to the American people, and to a large extent the people of the world, too. We've got serious problems.
And it's all justified by 9/11. That's incredible. I mean, what would happen if we could ever get the truth out? I mean, how do you respond to people who, like, don't get it and they don't want to go there? I mean, does that surprise you sometimes? Because it does me sometimes, and I just wondered how you felt about that.
It surprises me every time. And I don't know why, because most people are just like that, as you described. They're in denial. They cannot handle their frame of reference being messed with. I mean, we're talking about a massive problem here that's obviously a conspiracy, right? But we don't have theories about how this has worked, put together, or who did it. We focus on the technical evidence, but immediately imply that we're not safe. You know, our government or large elements within it are not out for our best interests. Our congressional leaders who have not examined this, our media has not examined it, implies a level of complicity that goes way too high and too broad for us to imagine could be true. So it's threatening to our very psychological security, and most people can't handle it. So they just kind of put it aside as soon as you tell them, if they'll even let you tell them, if they don't get indignant while you're telling them, then they won't look at the evidence. And so what I do in those situations, to answer your question, is I move on to somebody that's more open-minded. That's all I can do. We plant seeds, and, you know, the third time they hear that subject, they might be more open-minded and begin to listen.
Right, right, when they hear it from more than one source or something. That's the only hope we can have, I guess. But what I really like about your group, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, is that you really do things. You keep putting out movies and booklets, and you're taking on NIST and going to all these conferences. And now you have this New England tour coming up. And maybe you could tell us a bit about where you're going to be. I know one of the stops is going to be in Torrington, Connecticut. We could talk a bit about that. You're going to be showing the movie that we showed here in September, but, you know, not everybody got to see it. So if they missed it then, they can come out to Torrington and catch it. So maybe you could talk a little bit about your tour and the movie.
Yeah, you bet. I was delighted to come to Hartford and premiere the film there. It was actually the first showing of the film anywhere. And you and your crew out there, including Wayne and others, worked so hard to make that a success. And now we're gearing up for a tour through the whole of the Northeast and New England. We start in Newark, though, with a unique opportunity at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Yeah. Tony Zambodi, one of our engineers, signed on to our petition, is going to team up with me to speak to more than 100 civil engineering students at a forum that is expected to be quite lively and controversial in a kind of a debate exchange with one of the professors there who will be supporting the official story. So that happened, the New Jersey Institute of Technology, and we'll be there on the 11th of November at 2:30. And then we start the actual film tour, Firefighters, Architects, Engineers, Expose 9/11 Myths. And this is very, very powerful movie that brings Eric Lawyer to the fore, who founded Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, which has over 200 firefighters calling for a new investigation. Eric has a unique perspective as a 14-year firefighter. He came later to Ground Zero and interviewed several firefighters. He talks about the mishandling of evidence, in particular by NIST, destruction of evidence, the procedures of handling a fire or explosion investigation, why explosions should, well, there's every reason that explosion should have been investigated, the evidence for explosions. It's extraordinary. So together, we start in New Brunswick, New Jersey on the 12th, and then we hop up to, I'll be introducing the film and answering Q&A. We'll have quite a series of discussions. Eric will appear with me in the film only. But we go up to Woodstock, New York on the 13th. We're in Torrington on the 14th, Greenfield, Massachusetts on the 15th, Brattleboro, Vermont on the 15th. Also, like, so if one of those is in the afternoon, one's in the morning. We have a total of 12 events in 10 days. It's really quite a tour for me. Worcester on the 16th. And then on the 17th, 18th, and 19th, we are going to take on this conference in Boston with 10,000 architects. We're going to be reaching with this evidence, our brochure, our DVD. We're going to try to sign up 200 more architects as co-sponsors for their next year's resolution that we will submit again on the floor at the annual convention of the American Institute of Architects. This is pretty exciting, because we came last year with 50, the minimum 50 architects calling for a new investigation, and we really riled them up. We put the evidence in as many minutes as we had before the entire leadership of the American Institute of Architects, including the board, who retorted with a series of untruths and lies and manipulations and accusations that really exposed them quite severely.
Unbelievable.
To their own people. We didn't win that vote. People aren't quite ready, but we're going to just keep at it until we do. We found a weak spot, an Achilles heel in the Association of 80,000 Architects.
Wow, that's really fantastic. Yeah, and as you said, once they become more exposed and they can get a little bit more courageous about challenging their own organization, maybe you'll get some more people to join you.
Yeah, I think so. And then we invite those architects to the Watertown, Massachusetts event, which is right there near Boston, on the 19th. And then on the 20th, we're in Dover, New Hampshire, and then the 21st, Belfast, Maine, which is right up here, Portland, and 21st in the evening, Brunswick, Maine, and then on over the next day, the 22nd, to Lebanon, New Hampshire.
Wow, that's a fantastic tour. And let me just tell people about the Torrington stop. So it's going to be November 14th, it's a Saturday, at the Trinity Episcopal Church.
At 220 Prospect Street.
In Torrington, Connecticut. And again, it's the Trinity Episcopal Church.
At 220 Prospect Street.
In Torrington. And 7 o'clock, the doors open at 6:30. And so please come out and support this effort and meet Richard Gage and learn more about why his organization is making so much progress and is so successful and why he feels the way he does and what the science is telling us about how the towers fell and, you know, how you've been lied to. Richard, is there anything else you'd like to share with the audience?
Yes. The evidence for the Twin Towers is equally overwhelming and convincing to most people. And people need to understand that those towers came down in 12 seconds. The structure was completely shattered. There are four-ton structural steel sections. After witnesses hear explosion that are sent laterally 600 feet in every direction at 60 miles an hour. We have squibs or isolated explosive ejections occurring 20, 40, even 60 stories down below this so-called pancaking collapse, which reveals no pile of 110 floors at the bottom, only a two-story pile of miscellaneous metals. I mean, 90,000 tons of concrete was pulverized. This didn't happen at the bottom after the collapse. It happened in midair after witnesses, hundreds of them, hear explosions. Massive series of synchronized explosions are described in detail in our DVD, 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. People can see all this evidence, including evidence of nanothermite found in all the World Trade Center dust samples, and the residue of thermite found by officials from the USGS. All that is very, very well documented in this DVD, and I encourage everybody to not only see it, but show it to everybody you know, and send the AE911truth.org link to every architect and engineer that you can find, and every media official and your own elected representatives.
Yeah, absolutely. And Richard, what's next after the tour, other than a few weeks of rest? What's next for you and the organization?
Oh, we're putting together a very exciting project, which is the dynamic analysis of World Trade Center 7 that will rival, well, certainly pull the rug out from underneath NIST's fraudulent finite element analysis study of this building, which they won't release the input data on. Their computer model actually pulls the rug out from underneath their own theory. But this study, which we're raising funds for from our membership, which is a very expensive study, is expected to go through academic circles with great interest and fury and lots of controversy, of course. But it's an open, transparent model that is the architects and engineers from our signer list are sponsoring with our initial pre-launch actually this week. So next week, everybody will be hearing about it.
Oh, that's great. And I know you've been, you know, your organization has been battling NIST about all of this. You've done freedom of information requests that they won't release the information. Are you doing lawsuits also against them? Or maybe you could tell us where you're at in the process with them, or is that something you can't talk about?
We're certainly suing NIST for the release of the information that we have requested under the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA. They have illegally withheld information. See, the government can't hold on to non-classified information, and this is not classified. Now, they did say that they wouldn't release their input data because they had an excuse it would jeopardize public safety. But we have actually now asked from NIST and FEMA for all of the information that they've used to conduct their interviews, including their videos and their documents that they have put together. This is a huge undertaking that they have now resisted for a year, and the lawsuit was submitted last month to the court. So we're very excited about that, because when they have been sued by us in the 9/11 Truth Movement before, they have at that point always responded. So
okay.
They don't have a legal leg to stand on for the rest of this information.
Now, is FEMA also withholding information?
Yes. FEMA and NIST are going back and forth saying, he has it, or they have it. They kept this. No, we returned it to them. So
yeah.
That's the excuse that they have been using, but we've kind of got them cornered now.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder what they're hiding. I guess you probably know.
Yeah, well, when you conduct a massive operation of fraudulence against the American people like this, there's a lot to hide, and they do not want this information released, but they have no legal way to hold on to it. So in a court of law, it just comes down to getting it. It's just how long can they hold on to it? You know, it'd be another year probably.
I guess then time is on their side in a sense. The longer they can prolong it, the better for them.
Time is on their side because the closer, you know, the more time it goes by, the closer we may be to the next 9/11 style false flag event, which is what this was a classic example of, where one country attacks themselves and then blames another in an effort to manipulate their people to go to war.
Yeah, that's to me is one of the key reasons to get at 9/11 truth so that we can catch them and they won't do another one, or at least they might think twice about it. So I agree with you that that's really important. Well, Richard, I'm going to look forward to seeing you on November 14th out in Torrington. And is there a website where people can go to see the whole tour?
Yes, and that will be on our website. The website is ae911truth.org. And also, it may be up on our Facebook page, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Fantastic. Okay, so I encourage people to check that out and go to one of the events. All right, Richard, well, thank you very much for being on the show and for all that you do for 9/11 Truth.
Thank you, Cheryl. Really appreciate the opportunity.
And again, you were just listening to a recent interview with architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which now has over 2,300 architects and engineers who state that the government account of what happened to the Twin Towers and Building 7 on 9/11 can't possibly be true because it defies the laws of physics. They have gathered definitive evidence of controlled demolition. I encourage you to check out their website, ae911truth.org, and if you'd like to see the new film, Firefighters, Architects and Engineers Expose the Myths of 9/11, and meet Richard Gage in person, please join us in Torrington, Connecticut, at the Trinity Episcopal Church at 220 Prospect Street on Saturday, November 14th at 7 p.m. And again, that's 7 p.m. Saturday, November 14th, 220 Prospect Street, Torrington, Connecticut. And if you live in another state, please check out the website for Architects and Engineers for the other New England locations. And since we're talking about controlled demolition, I'm going to end the show today with part of the song Building 7, The Smoking Gun, created and sung by our local talent, Carl Seeger Henry, Gary Fox Jr., and Mark Saunders.
Building 7, The Smoking Gun. It tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It tells the truth. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. At the World Trade Center, three buildings came down, hit by two planes, panic all around. But Building 7 had barely a scratch, not hit by plane, yet it still collapsed. And office fires were blamed for that. Building 7, The Smoking Gun. It tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It tells the truth. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. The first responders saw molten steel. They heard explosions, for they were real. And we all watched a scene surreal. Those buildings fell with roaring blast. A demolition controlled and fast. Building 7, Smoking Gun. It tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It Building 7. Oh, 9/11. Building 7. We want the truth. What's the real cause? So many questions, it gives one pause. The official story, so full of flaws. Our leaders command us to just move on. We're here to tell you we won't move on. We're here to tell you we won't move on. We're here to tell you we won't move on.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Millions march New York City and New York City shut it down, both of which are part of the Black Lives Matter movement, held a rally in Washington Square Park decrying police violence against African Americans. Protesters rallied and marched over recent deadly police shootings in Chicago of Laquan McDonald in October 2014 and Minneapolis. Protesters were also marching in solidarity with five activists who were shot while protesting the Minneapolis incident.
The five activists were shot by white supremacists who targeted those demonstrating near the 4th Precinct police station in Minneapolis in the aftermath of the death of Jamar Clark, who was shot in the head and killed while handcuffed by a police officer. At one point, the demonstrators in New York went into Macy's at Herald Square, and at another point, a group that tried blocking the Lincoln Tunnel.
And tonight's program is dedicated to Jamar Clark, to Laquan McDonald, and the loss of lives of all our young brothers and sisters at the hands of the police.
And now to the protest.
To all my Black Lives Matter family, we in New York City stand with you in solidarity. We will win or die trying. We rise. You cannot silence us. You cannot stop us. We will not draw back. For every life you take, another soldier will rise.
Right.
We are once again grieving and outraged by the state killing of Laquan McDonald, 17 years old. We believe these killings serve a more robust plan to once again enslave, oppress Black, brown, and Native peoples.
Right.
Fist up!
Fight back!
Fist up!
Fight back!
Now, Vienna from Millions March, give it up!
Woo! No justice!
No peace!
These racists!
Police!
These racists!
Police!
We are here in solidarity with Minneapolis and Chicago against white supremacy and police terror. What is happening to the activists at the 4th Precinct shutdown are acts of state-sanctioned white terrorism. These are direct attacks on our movement by white supremacists who want to create a climate of fear to stop us from organizing, assembling, and protesting. But we refuse to be intimidated. If they think these attacks will scare us away, they massively underestimate the power of the people.
Woo!
Right. They have no idea how strong the revolutionary love we have is and how strong our fight is. In fact, it is the state that is scared. It is the white power structure that is scared. They are armed with weapons of war, but they are terrified of us and our voices because they see the power of the people and they see us rising up and they know this movement is not going to stop until Black Lives Matter.
Right.
These recent events have shown us again how necessary it is that we continue organizing. We have thousands of people organizing, but what we need is a mass movement of millions of people organizing across this country. I am here as an Asian in solidarity with Black Power. My family's from Hawaii, and I have seen what white supremacy and white colonialism has done to the Native Hawaiian people and all Indigenous people. It is the duty of all of us non-Black minorities to fight for Black lives, because the privilege and opportunities we have in America today came on the backs of Black and Native resistance. Our freedom is tied together. We will not be silent. We will not retreat. We will keep fighting until Black Lives Matter. All power to the people.
All power to the people!
Next up, we have Josmar with Coalition to End Broken Windows. No new NYPD in New Yorkers against Bratton.
Give it up for my brother Josmar.
My mom was in Latin America in the 80s under dictatorships. Where your ass would get disappeared like this. It was normal, part of your schedule, to think that you might not show up to see your family someday. We as a movement now, we've been out here for a year, and many of us have been out here for many, many years. What are we going to do to step up and take the next step in this movement? People are getting shot at. I got to walk the street thinking they're going to shoot me for coming out here and speaking my mind. We have to make it very clear to ourselves what the veterans in this movement have done. We are in a straight-up war. Self-defense is the bare minimum we should be doing. The people who are retweeting you, the people who are online, they ain't in your community. Get to know the people on your block. Get to know the people on the corner, the young men and women who's there in those communities. Get to know them. You ain't going to tweet about it. I'm not going to call the cops about it.
No way.
So make sure you know who is in your circle. Who is really there for you? We need our community. When we're out there speaking our minds, we got to step up and we got to figure it out. There ain't no safe spaces out here. There never was. For all the people who died, for the Panthers, for all the people who lived through COINTELPRO, they ain't have no safe spaces. They was getting shot up in their own house. So we need to, as a movement, yes, we took a big step, but what's our next step? We need to get serious about it. And we need to reach out to the people who are there in the communities, the ones who are living it every day, the ones who maybe ain't at every protest, but they live in a protest every day when they have to live and they have to survive and they scrap and put it together. The people we're marching for, we got to bring them in as family. It can't be only about hashtags and coming out. It got to be about self-defense, community organizing, and knowing that this sister got my back, I got her back. What is the next step? You may have an idea, somebody else has another idea, but whatever it is, it's got to be an escalation because it is escalating all around us. And if we don't come together, we don't have any idea about what's around the bend. We don't come together and we don't really fight back. Not just a slogan. You fight back, look them right in the face when you don't back down.
That's right.
Yeah. No justice!
No peace!
These races!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
Next, we will have Minister Richard Price.
Come on, let's keep that energy, come on.
This might be the seventh, eighth, or ninth time that many of us have gathered because our brothers and sisters are being shot down heinously and there's nothing being done. So what do we want?
Justice!
And when do we want it?
Now!
There is a mother and a father in Chicago upset a whole community because of what happened with one Laquan McDonald. And this is about those of us who cannot sleep at night because we're worried about what's going on, that black lives still don't matter. This is a systematic thread woven through the fabric of our United States. And the only way that you can do anything is to get involved. It's in the academy where we go to school. It's in the school system. It's in healthcare. It's in politics. So whatever you do, come with feet ready to move. Come with mouths ready to be open and follow the chance. Because we're here as an extension of something much bigger. Something much greater.
Cops and the Klan go hand in hand. Cops and the Klan go hand in hand.
Next, we got Shannon from Y Accountability. We all see it already.
This is the fork in the road where we are. Relentless disdain and indignation against operational terrorism by police departments all across this country. It is not enough for you to come out tonight. Where will you be tomorrow? Will you watch your friends and neighbors shop and forfeit their collective economic power to corporatocracy that will abuse you when Models and the Yankees give money to law enforcement, but not a Kyla Gurley, but we walk around with Yankee fitteds, we are forfeiting our collective economic power. Hold your economic power. Harness your resources. You speak with your pocketbook and you speak with your feet. Black America is under a test. Bring your asses outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get off the goddamn Facebook. Get off of Snapchat. We are at a crossroads in Black America, who disproportionately and disparately suffers stop and frisk, police killings, discrimination, lack of education. Bring your asses out here. We're gonna shut this down.
If we don't get it, if we don't get it,
shut it down.
If we don't get it,
shut it down.
If Minneapolis don't get it,
shut it down.
If Juan McDonald don't get it,
shut it down.
Next up, we got Kirby from Answer Coalition and also Minneapolis 2015 is Birmingham 1964. All we have is each other. We are surrounded by police right now. And they can shoot us, and some vigilante can shoot us. Trayvon was killed by a vigilante.
Talk about it.
That's right.
People out here marching and fighting because in Chicago, in Ohio, there's no indictment. They won't even tell us what happened to Jamar Clark. They're not even releasing the names of the officers that shot him point blank above his eye.
Yeah.
We're watching videos of young people getting shot 16 times. See, there was always a war. The thing is, we didn't start it. But we got to be organized enough to protect each other. And we got to be damn serious about it. And we have a duty to stand up for each other and to fight back. This is a national, worldwide call for us to come together and fight together. Can you imagine a mother not knowing the details of her son's case? Or you telling your mom you're going to a protest and then they calling her to let her know that you've been shot by somebody who documented on social media that they were going to get some niggas today, and yet they can't find them. They don't know where they're at. You can't find people that decided to kill us. What does that show? We're lower than we think we are in their eyes. But I'm not worried about their eyes. I'm worried about us looking at each other. We don't know what's in store tonight. We out here gathered in unity, but we don't know who's getting arrested. We don't know who's getting beat up. All we know is that we stand with Minnesota from our heads to our toes. We do it because we understand 100% that if we're not united family, we what? We fall. We have a sign right here that says the ultimate truth. You cannot have capitalism without racism. This system is not broken. It's just not meant for us. We're entering a new phase of this movement. Baltimore is everywhere. Minneapolis is everywhere, and Ferguson is everywhere. Ferguson changed the tone, but it's not over. If we don't stand together, but I'm not going to sit here and act like white terror isn't real. We have students on campuses talking about they want to organize white student union.
Yeah. What's that?
It is about us coming together and respecting each other's experiences and respecting our backgrounds, taking what we know and taking it out to our communities. We out here at Washington Square Park. We should be in River Park Tower. We should be in the Bronx. We should be in Brownsville. Can you imagine how people would feel seeing a crowd like this in some of the most oppressed communities in our city? They face that racism, that police terror every day. Asada said this, and it's true. We have a duty to fight for our freedom.
Yeah.
And we stand with Minnesota because they are
understood this. Even in these high school students who walked out, they understood that history was in their hands. But I'm not just talking about marching. I'm talking about victory for our people that's been stepped on. Because we have power. I'm not going to sit here and talk about any more negatives. I'm going to talk about the positives within us. The Panthers started with two individuals, and they scared this system. What do you think? What do you think this is doing to them now? We have to be prepared, family. We have to be organized, but we have to fight. I need you to fight. Thank you.
Next we have up is Justice League NYC, Antoinette.
You know, I'm Antoinette. This is Carmen. We represent Justice League NYC, and we are here to stand in solidarity with our family in Minnesota, our family in Chicago, Ferguson, those five who got shot, you know, doing the same thing that we do every time something like this happens. So yesterday, Commissioner Bratton addressed the NYPD Ocean Ceremony, and in his remarks, he stated that nonviolent protests against police violence last November and December led to the killings of NYPD officers, right? His, like, exact words were that we have been through quite a lot this past year, beginning with the demonstrations in last November and December, the street demonstrations that led to the murder of two of our police officers. You know? The last time we checked, Commissioner Bratton is the one who still employs a killer on the payroll. Daniel Pantaleo. And in light of this increasing violence toward anti-violent protesters, we definitely believe that statements like Bratton's are dangerous, inaccurate, irresponsible, and continue to shift the blame from the people with the guns to the people with the signs. So we refuse to accept that. And that's why Mayor de Blasio and Commissioner Bratton and NYPD will continue to see us in the streets until our justice is served. So we are planning future nonviolent demonstrations on December 3rd. That is the one-year anniversary of Eric Garner's, the non-indictment of
Officer Daniel Pantaleo.
And we are committed to putting a chokehold on this city the same way that they put that illegal chokehold on Eric Garner and heard him say 11 times that he could not breathe and did nothing. And then blamed us for the killing of NYPD when all we seek out here is peaceful justice.
And Bill Bratton must be fired.
Bill Bratton must be fired.
Hey, hey, ho, ho. Bill Bratton has got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho. Bill Bratton has got to go.
Noche from Stop Mass Incarceration.
I want to start off by saluting the people and the courageous fighters in Minneapolis who had occupied the 4th Precinct day after day after day and refused to back down in the face of attacks. I want to salute the students in Mizzou who took over their campus. The challenge, the same white supremacist system that shoots us down the streets like dogs breeds racist hatred in the campuses all across this country. And I want to salute the fighters in Chicago who took the streets and refused to swallow the calm pill. They refuse to just shut up and say and be satisfied with charges, because we have seen this movie over and over and over again. Charges don't mean until killer cops are in cell blocks. Rakia Boyd, her killers were on trial, and the same goddamn prosecutors let them walk. They don't care about the killing of unarmed black and brown people. They are afraid of more Fergusons and more Baltimores and more Minneapolises and more Chicago. Millions of people rising up and taking down this monster and lifting it off the backs of the people of the world. Don't let them tell you it is impossible, because the only people who don't believe it's possible are the ones who need it. The monsters who run this country know it's possible, because they know that this system can fall. And we have to, yes, fight today, tomorrow, and the next day. December 3rd, anniversary of Eric Garner. Never forget. Never forget.
Understand that what happened in Minneapolis was not an isolated incident. We have white supremacist groups in New York. And that was proven when Hallowed Sons came and attacked us. Okay? We have police killing black and brown people every single day.
And we have a very new and real super evil out there by the name of Donald Trump. Yeah. Make no mistake about it right now. He is dangerous, okay?
Yeah.
The shooters, those animals in Minneapolis were heard saying 2016. That's not a coincidence, okay? So let's keep an eye on that. He's not a joke. He's not amusing. This ain't funny. He's dangerous. Okay? So we're going to begin the march. Okay? We did receive vague threats from stupid white supremacist groups about us gathering here. We are not afraid.
No, I'm not.
So if you see anybody like that, call it out.
Yeah.
Okay? So with that said, we're going to keep it tight. We're going to stay together. And we're going to start to march, okay?
Yeah.
So all lives will matter.
With black lives matter.
All lives will matter.
When black lives matter.
When black lives matter!
When black lives matter!
When black lives matter! Yeah! If we don't get no justice,
then they don't get no peace!
If we don't get no justice,
then they don't get no peace!
After all is said and done, when do we stand or will we just run? Did Medgar Evers die in vain? Have things progressed or do they remain the same? If they can shoot a black man for taking a stand on principle, thinking themselves invincible, making a sham of that word they call justice, how can we trust this? It's time to discuss this. Young Michael Stewart should not be forgotten. His death a tragedy, their verdict a travesty. So much to live for, young, gifted, and black. Yet he's no longer with us for compassion they lacked. Just like in the case of Eleanor, they murdered her. Remember her? A grandmother of meager means met her demise amidst the screams of maddening mayhem. A shotgun blast disabling her, yet enabling her to be a true witness to her last sight in life, as the flash of a 12-gauge now ended her life. After all is said and done, when do we stand or will we just run? From young Michael Stewart to Anthony Baez, the saga continues with no change of venue. Choked in America, roped in America, doped in America to think people can't.
And you are listening to Weldon Irvine. After all is said and done.
Once again, protesters took to the streets for Eric Garner, this time to mark 1 year since a grand jury's decision not to indict the officer responsible for his chokehold death during an attempted arrest.
It's the 1 year. Still nothing is happening here on Staten Island, you know. 1 year without justice, 1 year without an indictment.
We are here to demand justice, and we are here to demand an indict, convict, and send this killer cop, Pantaleo, to jail.
The encounter between the 43-year-old father of six and Officer Daniel Pantaleo was caught on cell phone video that went viral. When a grand jury decided there wasn't enough evidence to charge him for Garner's death, protests erupted all over the country. Thursday night, Garner supporters walked the streets again, past Borough Hall, the precinct station house where Pantaleo was assigned, to the courthouse, and finally to the Tompkinsville street where Garner died.
We want accountability of what happened to Eric Garner.
A small crowd also gathered outside Gracie Mansion, with some prominent demonstrators getting arrested. Officer Pantaleo has been placed on modified duty, stripped of his gun, but still on the payroll. Activists believe the mayor has the power to influence the NYPD in firing Pantaleo.
One of the reasons that I voted for him when he ran originally was, I wanted to see an end to stop and frisk. I wanted to see kind of an end to discriminatory policing.
The Justice Department is still investigating to see if civil rights charges should be brought against Pantaleo and has, in fact, asked the NYPD to put its case on hold as the feds finish their investigation.
He's still being paid. How is that possible? You know, when the world saw him commit this heinous act.
Garner's family says they will protest in his honor for as long as necessary to get justice for his death. In the meantime, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Brooklyn has given no timeline for when it expects to wrap up its case. On Staten Island.
Now to that other breaking story overnight. Five people shot at a Black Lives Matter rally in Minnesota.
When racial tensions were already high in Minneapolis after police shot and killed a Black man there about a week and a half ago. But this morning, folks in Minneapolis waking up to this headline. Police seeking three white male suspects in the shooting of five Black Lives Matter protesters.
Shortly before 10:45 p.m., witnesses say a dozen protesters tried to push back three men who turned and opened fire on the crowd.
I had just arrived, and there was a crowd trying to push the white supremacists back and, like, pushing out of the camp because they were, one person was like, they're reaching for a gun.
Bring all response cars in. Have them come. I'm going to need as many as I can.
Police are searching for three white male suspects.
We want justice for Jamar because justice for Jamar translates to justice for our entire community.
The protest here began a week ago after police shot and killed 24-year-old Jamar Clark.
Police in full riot gear.
Police claim Clark was a suspect in an assault case when he fought with them, leading to gunfire. But some eyewitnesses came forward to say Clark was handcuffed during the shooting. State investigators have announced the officer had no body or dashboard cam, but cell phone surveillance and ambulance cameras captured portions of the encounter. Protesters are demanding the release of those videos.
We want justice!
The spokesperson for the local chapter of Black Lives Matter, who organized the protest and attended the rally last night.
This has been ongoing for days, and it's come to a head tonight with the most violent thing I've ever seen in my life.
What happened last night was a planned hate crime and an act of terrorism against activists who have been occupying the 4th Precinct to demand justice for Jamar Clark, a Black man shot and killed by the Minneapolis Police Department. Despite earlier statements from police about the impending threat from white supremacists, the police instead maced citizen journalists and peaceful protesters. They made disparaging comments to those at the protests instead of taking the threat seriously. We reiterate that we have zero faith in this police department's desire to keep our community safe.
They say we will not be intimidated. They plan on being right back out there today.
A developing story in Chicago tonight. Protesters blocked entrances to stores and shut down traffic on Chicago's famous Magnificent Mile shopping area. They're calling for the city's top officials to step down after a deadly police shooting. They say the case was mishandled, and it's just an example of other issues inside the Chicago Police Department.
Release the tapes. All the tapes.
With Jesse Jackson and Congressman Rush, we're walking along with them now. Both of you gentlemen are here. As you're walking, you see the power of this march.
By Youth Project 100, Black Lives Matter, ministers, officials, all around a single proposition. In our urban areas, this is just the tip of the iceberg, of abandoned urban policy. In this case, while LeGuan has captured our attention, there has been a rush these last few days to bring about some relief. Those who saw the tape and held it up for 13 months must be made accountable. The police chief saw it, no doubt, and sat on it. And the nine police who were his accomplices who saw it did not recommend he be fired. And the state's attorney all need to go.
Thank you, Reverend Congressman Rush. What should happen now?
Well, we're going to keep marching. We're going to keep protesting. We're going to keep marching until we get it right. We haven't just started this. 45 years ago, we were in the same position with the murder of Fred Hampton and Marvin Clark. 46 years later, here we are again, police brutality. We want the state's attorney gone. We want clean, a new grand jury, a grand jury. We want the police indicted, an independent prosecutor. We want all of these things. Our fight for justice will not stop. These young people are taking the lead right now.
And I don't want to stop because as a young person, how do you feel to see all this happen?
So my name is Charlene Carruthers. I'm the national director of the Black Youth Project 100. Young black people from various organizations are calling on the police to be defunded. We live in a city where the Chicago Police Department takes up 40% of our city's budget, while just a few years ago, we closed over 50 schools. What signal does that send about the value of the lives of young black people when we don't have a school to go to? We need Mayor Rahm Emanuel to resign. We need Superintendent McCarthy to resign and not to be in a system where cops who kill our people not only take our lives, they take our money and they do not invest in our future.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
At any time, there'd be 20 or 30 patients on a ward, all with AIDS, and it was like a MASH unit. You would patch them up and send them out, and they'd be back weeks or months later with some other horrible infection. But the fact that there are 35 million people in the world today living with HIV, and that that information never makes it into the mainstream media, that troubles me.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Our news wrappers gave thanks for some time off during the U.S. holiday, but they'll be back next week. In the headlines so far, Uganda cracks down on queer-friendly NGOs, Vietnam and Bolivia each advance transgender rights, Cyprus lawmakers vote for civil unions, and Canada welcomes gay Syrian refugees. On this week's special World AIDS Day commemoration, with production assistance by Steve Pride and some music from the heart of the epidemic, our Rick Watts explores the past, present, and future of HIV/AIDS with Dr. Michael Gottlieb, one of the first practitioners to identify and treat the disease.
They are falling all around me. They are falling all around me. They are falling all around me. The teachers of my life are moving on.
How did you first come to be acquainted with what has since come to be known as AIDS?
It was 1981. I was a junior professor at UCLA. In the midst of a teaching exercise, I asked one of my postdoctoral fellows to find a patient who had a disease with immunologic features. And he went to the wards and came back to tell me about our first patient with AIDS. Of course, it didn't have a name at that time. He was a 31-year-old man with fevers and pneumocystis pneumonia, one of the opportunistic infections that we've since associated with the immune deficiency caused by HIV. In the next few weeks, we saw three more patients who were virtual carbon copies of the first patient, and it seemed at that time that something very unusual was going on, worthy of reporting to the health authorities. This was not a subtle illness. This was rather severe, dramatic, and life-threatening from the get-go. This was something that wasn't in any textbook. So we looked in the lab right away and with colleagues looked at the immune system under the microscope and found that this patient was deficient in these T cells called helper T cells or CD4 cells. And that seemed to be the basis of the immune deficiency. Something, some unknown event or exposure or toxin or even a virus was attacking this particular arm of the immune system. And there was a lot of speculation at first with a lot of wild theories as to what was causing this because our first four patients were all gay men There was the pauper theory. There was immune system overload. There was African swine fever. But from the get-go, we thought it was a viral disease because there was precedent for other viruses causing at least a transient or temporary immune system depression. And we thought that, in fact, the immune system damage in some of these patients might heal on its own, comparable to what we saw with some other viral diseases, but that wasn't to be the case with HIV.
Are there still people out there who think that HIV doesn't cause AIDS?
Yeah, there are a few people out there like that. I think there are fewer people like that than there used to be, because some of the people who, in fact, claimed that, in fact, were HIV positive and wound up dying of AIDS and their children dying of AIDS. So it's kind of difficult to, in those circumstances, to say that their HIV was not the cause of their ultimate immune deficiency and death. And let me just add that the treatments that we've developed that are aimed directly at HIV and at no other virus or dietary issue or any other claim, those treatments have turned around the HIV epidemic here in the United States such that people stopped dying as often as they did in the mid-1990s as a result of the institution and availability of life-saving medication directed against HIV specifically.
In those early days of the epidemic, when the government wasn't paying attention, you had all these patients that were coming into you, and there wasn't a lot that you could offer them.
Oh, that was awful. That was just awful. We had these AIDS units in various hospitals, and at any time there'd be 20 or 30 patients on a ward, all with AIDS, and it was like a MASH unit. You would patch them up and send them out, and they'd be back weeks or months later with some other horrible infection. And I remember patients very well by name and what they looked like and just how much I wanted to help them. In the period of time that was covered in the Dallas Buyers Club movie, when we had so little to offer patients, I still remember patients who we lost because we just didn't have medications. And just how much they wanted to survive and how much we wanted to help them. And yet we were powerless to do anything but provide comfort care and let them know we were trying. I think it helped them to know we were trying, that we were still doctoring, that we were still listening to them and hearing about their lives and what made them happy and in the times they were out of hospital. But it was a very awful experience for anybody in the medical profession, specifically myself. It was a painful experience.
What was the most difficult part of sounding the alarm to alert everyone that something was going on that they needed to pay attention to?
Well, the most difficult part was trying to figure out how to do it. I was an immunologist by training and not an infectious disease doctor. And so my first instinct was to call the editor of a medical journal rather than the CDC. Fortunately, the editor of the medical journal suggested that I call CDC. And once I called CDC, there really was no problem in sounding the alarm. CDC recognized that it might be important and invited us to submit our cases for publication. They were published. They were widely read across the United States. People in other cities who were seeing patients said, aha, here is what we've been seeing. It's the same thing as these people are reporting in the journal. That was no difficulty. I think there was resistance, certainly in the gay community, to accepting the fact that there was something new, that there was something possibly affecting that community more than other communities. People, for good reason, wanted to go on with their lives. They didn't necessarily want to believe that there was some new threat.
Where did HIV come from? Is it new, or was it newly recognized?
Well, it was newly recognized in 1981, but pretty clearly there were some cases, a smattering of cases happening in other cities prior to our description of the disease in 1981. From looking at frozen specimens of blood from blood donors in the United States, it's pretty clear that HIV was certainly here as early as 1977. And further studies of frozen specimens revealed an HIV-positive specimen from Zaire from 1958. And so pretty clearly it's a virus that was percolating out there under the radar for a long time. And even further studies date its crossover from the chimp species into humans as early as 1915. And the crossover from primates to humans is pretty easy to explain because protein sources in sub-Saharan Africa are scarce. People do eat what they can kill in the bush, and they can kill chimps and other primate species. And one can imagine a hunter butchering an animal, cutting themselves. In the course of doing that, the mixing of the blood occurs, and the virus jumps from the chimpanzee species over to the human species. And this event is actually thought to have happened at least five times in history in sub-Saharan Africa.
If someone contracts HIV, do they always develop AIDS if left untreated?
Most people who contract HIV do go on to develop AIDS. However, there's a small percentage of people who are what we call long-term non-progressors, where their own immune system seems to contain HIV and work against it, and they're protected from developing the immune system burnout that leads to the opportunistic infections. And those patients are actually very interesting, have been widely studied in terms of what it takes to contain HIV. And that's very relevant to HIV vaccine development, to know how certain patients are able to get a handle and squelch the virus.
We have heard a lot recently about something called PrEP. Is it a good idea or not?
I think it's unnecessarily controversial. It is just one more thing that a person who's HIV negative can do in addition to safer sex and condoms to protect themselves against HIV. The science is sound. The medication, Truvada, is available with prescription. It has to be used properly, correctly, and those of us who prescribe it take special pains to educate our patients who are HIV negative how to use Truvada in addition to other measures to protect themselves against contracting HIV. There are people who will not use it according to the instructions, and they are taking some risk. But if they're already not using condoms, and we know that gay men are using condoms perhaps 50% of the time on average, it seems to me that it is an important harm reduction strategy to make Truvada available even to patients who aren't practicing safer sex, as at least an effort to prevent their contracting HIV. The science of PrEP is good, and my experience so far is that patients that I've prescribed it for are using it very responsibly and have not changed the nature of their sexual life.
Rick Watts continues his discussion with pioneering HIV/AIDS practitioner Dr. Michael Gottlieb.
To those young folks who are HIV negative and say, well, it's no big deal, I'll just take a pill every day, it is a big deal. I don't know anybody with HIV who wouldn't want to turn back the clock to a time when they were HIV negative.
After this important brief message.
Hi, I'm News Wrap reporter Carol Myers. It's that time of year again, when many of our U.S. listeners consider ways to maximize their annual charitable tax deductions.
And I'm News Wrap reporter Wenzel Jones. No matter where you are in the world, we need your help. Log on to thiswayout.org to do your part to keep this nonprofit volunteer-based show going.
You'll also find some unique musical, cultural, and historical programming from the This Way Out archives as our way of saying thank you. And those CDs make unique holiday gifts, too.
Please go to thiswayout.org to support our efforts to inform, entertain, and educate listeners around the world. Or postal mail P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA.
From the This Way Out family to you and yours, happy holidays, and thank you.
Our year-end campaign officially kicks off on hashtag Giving Tuesday, December 1st. Hurry on over to thiswayout.org and make every day in December a hashtag Giving TWO Day for This Way Out.
Brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother.
This is Essex Hemphill, reminding you that you've tuned into This Way Out.
Turn me around, keep on walking, keep on talking.
There's a world in a bubble tonight. Some say we sit by as it rips. Silence, sanctions, action guides. The poison, the greed, and the love side by side by side. But the love survives until the balance dips. We wait in shadow. We live what we know with a prayer on our lips until the balance dips. The pain we pull through, the good we can do is a prayer on our lips until the balance dips.
This is Rick Watts, and I'm talking with Dr. Michael Gottlieb, who in 1981 first discovered AIDS and wrote the first paper sounding the alarms on AIDS. To look at the medication advertisements or to listen to some folks, I get the feeling that there's a perception out there that HIV is no longer a big deal anymore. Are they right or wrong, and why?
It is a big deal. I don't know anybody with HIV who wouldn't want to turn back the clock to a time when they were HIV negative. Saying that, people can live comfortably, productively, healthy lives with HIV, provided that they can get the medication they need and that they take it. I have some issue with depicting everybody with HIV as looking very healthy, totally well, very sexy, because it minimizes the impact that HIV is in fact having on them, that they may look very well, which is great, but they are still coping with being HIV positive. The drugs and the condition itself has long-term consequences with respect to what we call the comorbidities, things that come along with the disease state, osteoporosis for some patients and for some drugs, higher incidence of heart disease and diabetes, all associated with being HIV positive.
Side effects of these medications and long-term tolls to the body.
With regard to side effects, I would say that over the years, the medical community has attempted to weed out the drugs that are most associated with side effects, such as neuropathy, painful fingers and toes. We have avoided the drugs that do that, and we used them in the 90s. But we've constantly refined medication regimens to minimize side effects, and the new regimens are, in fact, very effective and much cleaner with regard to side effects than the older ones. That said, there's still a requirement to take medication every day. And there are still some side effects associated with medication. And so it's better for people to avoid HIV and not have to take medication. So to those young folks who are HIV negative and say, well, it's no big deal, I'll just take a pill every day, it is a big deal.
How do you work with these issues and keep them manageable from a medical standpoint and a quality of life standpoint?
Well, we're constantly reviewing patient medication regimens with our patients, trying to weed out medications that may be causing a side effect, such as high cholesterol or high triglycerides. We constantly try to refine our regimens. Now that HIV for doctors is easier to manage, we also are paying more attention to these comorbidities, to getting back to being just regular doctors again, looking at blood pressure issues, blood sugar issues, cholesterol issues, the typical issues associated with an aging population. 50% of people living with HIV in this country are over 50 years of age. So if there are 1.3 million living with HIV, that's roughly 700,000 people with HIV over age 50.
Not that long ago, we'd have been surprised to hear about that. People are finally living long enough.
In the 80s and early 90s, the situation was pretty bleak, and we couldn't imagine taking care of 80-year-olds with HIV, and indeed, in my own practice, there are several. Those patients are very happy to still be with us, and their quality of life is actually very good.
Any developments on the horizon that look particularly promising to you?
Well, one thing that looks interesting is the ability to take medication less frequently. There are a couple of drugs in development that may allow a person to be treated once a month with an intravenous preparation of medications with a very long, what we call half-life, one that sticks around for a long time. And that would be particularly applicable to patient populations who are not as obsessive and not as adherent to taking their daily medicine. A couple of other things are interesting. One of them is cure research, where there is, in fact, one bona fide HIV cure. I met him most recently for the first time at the U.S. Conference on AIDS in San Diego, Timothy Brown, the so-called Berlin patient. And we had a great opportunity to chat and had some photos taken together. And it's just exciting for me to meet somebody who, through heroic measures, was able to eliminate HIV very convincingly, which says that, yes, it can be done. My own view is that it's not going to be easy. There's got to be a better way than what Mr. Brown went through, which were bone marrow transplants for leukemia, which was a second disease that he had. But researchers at medical centers are working on easier ways to rid the body of HIV. I don't think it's going to be next week or the week after, but it may be something on a 5 or 10 year plan. I have to say that it's great when the media cover HIV at all these days, because they rarely do. But they kind of go overboard on some developments. That, of course, is because the news media cover something new in a disease state. They don't cover a disease that's endemic, like HIV, that's part of the background of illness in America. They cover epidemic, like Ebola. The fact that there are 20,000 cases of Ebola in West Africa, yes, that is big news, I agree. But the fact that there are 35 million people in the world today living with HIV, and that that information never makes it into the mainstream media, that troubles me.
So much progress has been made with HIV over the 30-plus years since you documented it. Has that had an impact on the research and treatment of other diseases?
Oh, very definitely. The gains that we've made in HIV have been the model for the development of treatments for other diseases. The drugs that are now being rolled out for the treatment of patients with chronic hepatitis C were developed using the same model, the same combination cocktail approach that we used for HIV. And this model may be applicable to other disease states, other viral illnesses. There was kind of a revolution in biotechnology. The availability of monoclonal antibodies and the availability of DNA technology. And in mid-1990s, we got access to what's called the viral load test for HIV, which proves to be the new gold standard of success in therapy. But we didn't have anything like that prior to the mid-90s, just 20 years ago. And that's been invaluable in the management of HIV. So we, in a sense, have been lucky to have the access to these tools to deal with the HIV epidemic. And it goes back to the idea that basic research pays dividends.
In the now 30-plus years since you first sounded that alarm, what have been your most encouraging and inspiring moments in this epidemic?
There have been a lot of inspiring moments. Our patients inspired us early on, patients who knew that we didn't have what we needed to help them, but we were doing the best we could. They appreciated that, and they didn't in any way critique us for not having the answer. And the gay community has been very inspirational with regard to establishing community organizations and activism such as ACT UP, putting pressure on the regulatory agencies to make drugs available sooner. All of that's been very inspiring. I was fortunate to be involved with Miss Elizabeth Taylor in her work in fundraising for HIV and creating awareness for HIV. And of course, I met her in the aftermath of my caring for Rock Hudson when he had AIDS in the mid-80s. And that event was kind of a pivotal event, a tipping point, if you will, in the public's awareness of the disease and the epidemic. Prior to Rock Hudson, the AIDS epidemic was very hush-hush, and after that event, people began to be more aware of it and develop some sense of empathy for people who were living with the virus.
What do you say to someone coming into you now as a new HIV patient?
There's several types of patients. Some patients come in never having tested for HIV, and once they test, they find that they're positive. They may have had some inclination that they were positive, and that's why they never tested. And so they come in, and we get a baseline as to where their disease state is at, and we can offer them medication. And we emphasize the adherence message, and we sit with them and with a menu of different options of medications, and they choose what's going to be most convenient for them and what side effects they're willing to put up with and what side effects they're not willing to put up with and how many times a day to take their medication. So those patients, I can pretty well tell them they'll do well and feel better and have a better prognosis once they start medication. I don't have a crystal ball to tell them that they're going to have a normal life expectancy similar to the age-matched HIV-negative person. Can't say that. The other type of patients I see are young men who are newly HIV-positive, just having converted. And I feel very badly in that circumstance because, as you know, there are 50,000 people every year who become newly HIV-infected. And many of those are young people who weren't taking precautions. And that's where this issue of PrEP comes in, pre-exposure prophylaxis. And when I see somebody 21 years old, newly HIV positive, I say to myself, what more could we have been doing to prevent this person from becoming HIV positive and having to deal with this for a lifetime? There's nothing different that I can do because it's too late. But of course, we will prescribe medication for that person, and their prognosis is excellent. But I certainly wish that we'd had an opportunity to intervene prior to their becoming HIV positive. And I feel fortunate that at least in my lifetime, we were able to advance the state of the art to where we are today, which is a much happier situation where I can tell someone, yeah, we can manage this.
Dr. Michael Gottlieb, it's been a real honor speaking with you. I think it's no exaggeration to say that many, many people here and around the world are still alive today because of what you have done and continue to do. This is Rick Watts.
Thank you, Rick.
Looking back to the good old days, times have made us change our ways, but I think we can still have fun. It all depends on how it's done. Oh, let me introduce you to a friend in my pocket, friend in my pocket. I've got a friend in a rubber in my pocket. It never lets me down, it's good to carry around, so if I need it, I've got it. Friend in my pocket, friend in my pocket, friend in my pocket.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Carol Myers, and Wenzel Jones contributed program material, with thanks to Steve Pride for production assistance. Michael Callan with Chris Williamson and Holly Neer, John Buccino and Joe Bracco performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible, especially during our year-end campaign. You'll find more information about that, the crew, our social media links, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WOZO Knoxville, Tennessee, KSOW Cottage Grove, Oregon, 7THE Hobart, Tasmania, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Against the grain, there's a population bomb brewing with enormous social and environmental consequences. No, I'm not talking about human beings. It's the immense growth in the number of livestock globally and the industrial system of production that has driven the explosive increase in animals for human consumption. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with political ecologist Tony Weiss about the meatification of our societies, North and South, and its effects on global warming, ecosystem destruction, and inequality. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Over the last several generations, meat consumption in the industrial societies of the global North, and increasingly for the middle classes of the global South, has skyrocketed. Meat has been seen as an indicator of social well-being and affluence, and the increase in meat consumption has been taken to be almost inevitable. But is it? My guest today argues that it's been driven by a specific economic system, industrial capitalism, that has created an enormous change in humans' relationship with both animals and agriculture, the shift from the production of food grains for human consumption to feed grains for fattening up animals. Political ecologist Tony Weiss joins me today to talk about the environmental and social consequences of industrial meat production. He's associate professor of geography at the University of Western Ontario and the author of The Ecological Hoofprint, The Global Burden of Industrial Livestock. That's published by Zed Books. He's also the author of The Global Food Economy, The Battle for the Future of Farming. Tony, I wonder if you could start by giving us an overview of the amount of meat consumption that takes place today on a global level and how it contrasts to the level of meat production in the 1960s.
Well, one of the starting points for the book is this term, the meatification of diets, that I use to try to describe how meat has shifted from the periphery of human diets, where it's been for the most of the history of agriculture, to the center. And if just we go back a few generations to say 1960, there were about 3 billion people on Earth at that time, and the average person on Earth was consuming about 23 kilograms of meat each year. Today, there's over 7 billion people on Earth, and the average person is consuming over 43 kilograms of meat per person per year. So that is near doubling of annual meat consumption on an average level in a world that has jumped from 3 billion or so people to 7 plus billion people. Further, the FAO projects that by 2050, in a world of somewhere between 9 and 10 billion people on Earth, there will be the average person will be consuming over 50 kilograms of meat per person per year, which is just a staggering increase. If you think, you know, in about a century, the more than doubling of average annual meat consumption on a global scale at a time when the human population will, if it does indeed reach 9 to 10 billion people as the UN projects, the human population will have tripled in about a century. So there is this staggering growth on an annual on the level of per capita annual meat consumption.
And you're talking globally, but of course, anything that's global is going to be quite varied. So when you talk about this enormous increase in meat consumption, just taking what we know, what's happened so far, rather than the projections into the future, is that an increase in meat consumption in the global north, in the wealthy countries? Is the global south part of that picture?
That's absolutely very important, is that there are incredible disparities in those global averages I was speaking about. So the average person in the U.S. consumes vastly more meat per on a per capita basis than the average person in, say, Africa or South Asia. So that is a really fundamental part of this picture, is that meatification is a very uneven phenomenon, that people in a general sense, and people in rich countries or industrialized countries, consuming vastly more meat per capita than people living in poorer countries. But the biggest change right now is happening in vast industrializing countries like China and Brazil. And this is where per capita levels of meat consumption are really driving some of the aggregate growth on a world scale.
So into the future, to mid-century, then, are the projections for increased meat consumption to be found in places that right now may be having a growing middle class, say, in the global south, rather than people in the global north who are already eating a lot of meat, eating even more meat?
Yeah, I mean, I think meat consumption in places like Canada or the U.S. or Western Europe is sort of plateaued. There's only so much meat bodies can absorb, and there's all kinds of health implications associated with that. The vast rising levels of meat consumption are overwhelmingly concentrated in so-called middle-income countries or fast industrializing countries, if you like. And China is the biggest biggest player here by far on an aggregate level. It's by far the world's leading producer and consumer of meat now on an aggregate basis.
What about other products that are connected to livestock and animal production, eggs and dairy? How have they fared in terms of their consumption over the period of time that you were speaking about, going back a couple generations?
So dairy has roughly grown at the same level, the same ratio as human population. So it's roughly grown in step with human population increases. Eggs has grown at a much faster rate. So eggs has grown not quite at the same rate as poultry flesh, but not much slower. So the biggest vectors of growth in terms of meat production and consumption on a world scale are poultry and pigs, and eggs have grown at similar ratios.
So then what's being displaced? So if dairy is more or less keeping up at the rate of population growth, eggs have increased somewhat, meat has increased a lot. What foods are being displaced in people's diets?
Sometimes it's not necessarily a case of displacement. People are just eating more.
So it's increased calories overall.
Well, and other nutrients. And as I inferred, there's lots of health implications, and there's lots of epidemiological evidence that this dietary trajectory is not healthy and is tied to a whole range of non-communicable diseases. The average American is consuming much more food than was consumed a half century ago, say. That is part of the story, is just absolute increases in food intake. And Julie Guthman has done some very interesting work on, how bodies are absorbing some of the surpluses of our agricultural system in very unhealthy ways. So that's part of, I think, an important part of the story of these absolute increases in food consumption is the growing surpluses and ways of absorbing them. And this is something I've stressed with the overall trajectory of agricultural production, is that the increasing production of animal flesh and derivatives, so milk and eggs, has provided a very powerful way of absorbing some of the surplus grain and oilseed production. So it can take surplus grains and oilseeds and convert them from price deflating millstones on production. So surpluses that would have a devastating impact on price is then, as they get absorbed in growing volumes of animal products, can absorb some of the surplus production and turn it into low margin sources of profit. So that is on the production side of things, I think, a very important dynamic here.
Right. So you've just started talking about the production side, and often when we hear discussions around food, and there are a lot of them in the media and elsewhere, the focus is on consumers. And the presumption, I think, when we hear that people are eating more meat is, that's consumer choice. Americans, Canadians, people in the wealthy parts of the world are demanding more food, more meat, as they are becoming more affluent. Is that a way that you think we should come at these questions?
It's a tricky question. I think consumption decisions are part of the story of why this trajectory is treated as inevitable and almost uncontestable. That trajectory I was mentioning earlier, that the average person on Earth by 2050 is projected to be consuming more than 50 kilograms of meat on an annual basis, is partly because it's assumed that as people get richer in certain parts of the world, they will demand more meat. And so that is, I think, a part of a very powerful narrative in agriculture about the need to increase production of grains and animal products, that this consumption is sort of inevitable, and it's rooted in, cultures and dietary preference. And I think a lot of the responses to the problems of this trajectory that I was speaking about does focus too much on individual consumer choice and not at the systemic level of the agricultural system that is producing what I call these oceans of monocultures and islands of concentrated animals and the economic imperatives that are organizing those productive environments in particular ways. And so I think On one level, talking about consumer choices and dietary decisions, I think, can open up into radical critiques of how systems are organized. I think there is also a danger that it can focus too much energy on just individual behavior and ethical consumption, and not thinking about the way productive environments are organized.
That's the voice of Tony Weiss. He is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Western Ontario in Canada and the author of The Ecological Hoofprint, The Global Burden of Industrial Livestock. You're listening to Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. I wonder if you could describe for us in effect, set the scene of how livestock production takes place today. What does it look like when we're thinking of agriculture and livestock on a global scale? What sort of systems are we even talking about?
When we're talking about the trajectory of meatification, those growing per capita levels of animal flesh consumption and animal derivatives consumption, we're not talking about growing production on small mixed farms. The driver of meatification on a world scale is intensive livestock operations or CAFOs or factory farms. There's a range of terms. I liken them to islands of concentrated animals within oceans of grain and oilseed monocultures. And I think that imagery of oceans of monocultures, maize and soybeans, and other various coarse grains and oil seeds, and the islands of concentrated animals, overwhelmingly poultry, birds, pigs, and increasingly, huge cattle feedlots and dairy cattle as well. And so that image of oceans of monocultures, islands of animals, through that, I try to stress how these productive environments are organized in parallel, according to particular industrial logic. And then, animals are disarticulated from land and then rearticulated to these oceans of grains and oilseed monocultures.
And just to be clear, the grains and oilseeds that you're talking about, that's the feed for these animals who are moved from whatever their natural setting might be to kind of concentrated environment where that sea of grain and oil seeds is sent their way as feed to fatten them up?
Yeah, absolutely. And so those oceans of monocultures, are not only used for livestock consumption on a world scale. There's about 10 crops that dominate the vast majority of the world's arable land. But if you look at the industrial monocultures that are dedicated to animal feed, you're talking about close to a third of the world's arable land of monoculture production that is geared to animal feed. So in this imagery of islands of animals, oceans of monocultures, those islands are commanding a very large share of the world's arable land.
And what do those oceans and islands what is the effect of those areas, the hoofprint, if you will, on the environment?
So that's one of the things I hope to do with the ecological hoofprint as a framework is to think about how these productive environments are organized and then as a way of thinking about the array of environmental implications organizing food production in this way. So, again, treating these systems in parallel, starting with the industrial monocultures. Think about the soil problems. And this is, one of the most fundamental problems associated with industrial monocultures is the heightened rates of soil degradation, the increased pest problems, the expanded definition of pests, the increased vulnerability to pests that are associated with monoculture production, the increased irrigation demands associated with drier soils and monocultures and thirstier seeds as high-yielding varieties tend to demand more irrigation, the increased mechanization that is associated with a considerable energy budget, and the fact that landscapes are specialized. You have vast landscapes in the U.S. that are defined by a single crop, the corn belt or the wheat belt. Product are moving much further. So when you think about the mechanization of production, the array of inputs that are needed to override the biological and physical problems in production, the fertilizer production and movement, the production and movement of chemical pesticides, the increased irrigation demands, the increased movement of things over space, and the fossil energy that courses through that whole system. I quote Brett Clark and Richard York with this great line that modern agriculture has become the art of turning oil into food. And I think when you think about the biophysical problems associated with industrial monocultures and the ways that they're overridden, it opens up a way of thinking about the resource budgets and pollution loads of those systems. So then if we move to industrial livestock operations in factory farms and feedlots. There are incredible concentrations of animals, unnatural concentrations of animals that create a range of problems, a range of barriers, what I call barriers to scale. And there are a whole host of ways that those barriers to scale are overridden. Lighting and temperature control, the confinement of animals to reduce the metabolic losses in terms of converting feed to flesh and other outputs, efforts to accelerate animal reproduction, expanded array of inputs, including not just feed, obviously, but subtherapeutic antibiotics to increase feed conversion ratios. As animals are confined in these spaces, there are there is great suffering, and the industry sometimes calls this stress, but I think it's better understood as psychosocial problems, behavioral pathologies, and this is overridden with a range of inputs, again, pharmaceuticals, physical mutilations, and that there's obviously disease risk posed by these great and unnatural densities of animals. So, pharmaceuticals, again, insecticides, disinfectants, increased water demand is just a fundamental part of these islands of concentrated animals to cope with the pathogens, contagion, and filth. And again, the specialization of landscapes that you have animals concentrated in these islands and often moving at various points in their lives from birth to feed to slaughter, moving over greater space. There's an energy budget in that movement. And then very crucially in all of this is that as so much of the world's arable land is commanded by these islands of livestock, much of the nutritional value of feed is lost in animal metabolic processes. So it basically, I talk about it as amplifying or magnifying the burden of those industrial monocultures.
So can you describe what you mean by the nutrients being lost?
Well, Francis Moore Lappe had this great phrase many years ago in A Diet for a Small Planet, where she talks about reverse protein factories. And what she was trying to do with that phrase was stress that for most of agrarian history, small mixed livestock populations grazed on the margins of farm households or grazed on crop stubble, scavenged from household wastes. There might have been some crops devoted to overwintering animals in temperate climates, but in a general sense, they didn't compete with humans for the product of arable land. So they were, that's this protein factory image she has. They were converting, various things into a usable nutrient for humans as eggs and milk and flesh, so that the protein factory is non-competitive, animals effectively as non-competitive or mostly non-competitive land uses in terms of not consuming crops. And when we begin to feed, and again, she identified this in Diet for a Small Planet in the early 70s, there was this growing process of feeding industrial grains to, at that time, mostly grains, and over time, oilseeds as well, like particularly soybeans. But at that time, grains predominantly to animals to produce flesh and eggs and milk. You're losing a lot of the nutritional content of that agricultural production. So she talks about this shift from non-competitive land uses generating some usable nutrition to human societies on a very modest scale in general, as I stressed earlier, on the periphery of diets for most of agrarian history. And now there is this devotion of huge areas of arable, the product of arable land, crops being fed to animals, and a lot of the usable nutrition being lost in animal metabolic processes.
Well, I want to return in a moment to the question of how do we understand this shift that's happened. But before we do that, let me just say that you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined today by political ecologist Tony Weiss. He is the author of The Ecological Hoofprint, The Global Burden of Industrial Livestock, that's published by Zed Books. You we're just talking about the environmental consequences in all sorts of different ways of this concentrated livestock production and the attendant agricultural system that it's dependent on. And I wonder if you could speak for a moment about the impact of livestock production on climate change, on global warming.
Yeah, this is something that has got a lot of attention in recent years. There have been a range of news media coverage of this subject. I think one of the biggest things to draw attention to the climate impacts of livestock production and diet was when the head of the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a few years ago said that diet is one of the biggest things that people can do when they think about their own impact on climate change. And there have been a range of estimates in terms of how much livestock production contributes to annual greenhouse gas emissions. There was a famous number that the FAO gave in livestock's long shadow of about 18% of annual greenhouse gas emissions attributable to livestock production. And then they subsequently, a few years later, revised that downwards to closer to 15%. But there have been other estimates that place this much higher. And there's a lot of complexity in terms of how that number gets measured, and can we just think about it in terms of annual emissions? And that's something I try and problematize and say we shouldn't just be thinking about the implication in terms of annual greenhouse gas emissions. But when we do just think about it at an annual level, the impact derives from many of the things I've talked about: the mechanization on farms, the fertilizer story, both the production and movement of fertilizers, which entails a huge fossil energy budget, and greenhouse gas emissions, also nitrous oxide emissions, pesticide production and movement, the pumping of irrigation against gravity and from aquifers, the movement of things over space, the heating and cooling of livestock environments, the movement of animals between various sites of production. There's a range of energy budgets that, as I've stressed, fossil energy is coursing through these productive environments, and there's impacts in terms of carbon dioxide emissions. There's also major livestock production on a world scale is a major source of methane and nitrous oxide. And it's also a major contributing factor to tropical deforestation, particularly in Amazonia, which has huge implications in terms of CO2 emissions but the other big part of the story that I think is really important to consider is it's not just the climate impacts of livestock production are not just about annual greenhouse gas emissions of CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, which again it has a very significant responsibility in, but the implications are bigger than that, I think, in the sense that when we think about the inefficiencies of how these productive environments are organized, it also relates to the fact that these environments command more land for agriculture than would need to be in production. And so their annual greenhouse gas emissions is only part of the story. We also need to be thinking about how they command more land that could be otherwise used for enhanced carbon sequestration, ecological restoration. And so that's why I think it's very difficult to give a precise number of the percentage of annual greenhouse gas emissions that are coming from livestock production in itself, because it's also important to take into account the fact that if nutrition was gained more efficiently, agriculture could occupy less space in landscapes, and that would reduce various resource budgets, and it could also as I said, enhance the capacity for ecological restoration and carbon sequestration.
But some critics might say, but if people switch to a primarily plant-based diet, moved away from meat, wouldn't the world need to use that space for agricultural production for humans?
Well, I think there is an overwhelming weight of evidence that eating less animal products relates to commanding less land for agriculture. And that's one of the big things that I try to stress with Ecological Hoofprint is that because livestock production commands so much arable land, if nutrition was derived more efficiently, less land would be needed for agriculture. And there's been various attempts to try to quantify, you know, just how much less land, say, a vegan diet requires than, say, a meat-intensive diet, because nutrition can be derived much more efficiently from plant-based nutritional sources. Now, there are some that argue there is a necessity for small mixed livestock populations in, say, permaculture systems. And Michael Pollan is a very famous food analyst who makes that case that basically, that, you know, there is a need, a functional need for animals in sustainable mixed farms, but that entails massively less meat consumption. So he has, you know, his famous line about eat mostly plants as one of his kind of primer dietary guidelines, I guess.
Wanted to ask you about what contradictions beset the system that you've been describing, what you call in your book the industrial grain oilseed livestock complex. You've been delineating very starkly all the different ways that it has an impact on the environment, and you also mentioned a public health dimension to it. And yet, of course, what we see with it is you have often high levels of productivity, low prices. So if one were to put aside the environment for a moment, which perhaps is impossible, but let's just do it for a second, what contradictions, if any, could keep this from being a sustainable model in every other sense?
Well, I think there's a whole range of what I call biophysical contradictions that run through this system. And again, starting with the soil and the amplification of soil degradation associated with industrialization. It's not to say that soil challenges, so soil conservation challenges, just began with industrialization. You know, David Montgomery wrote this great book called Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations, that looks at how the challenge of managing soil health has been present for agrarian civilizations since the beginning of cultivation. But the industrialization of agriculture has massively accelerated the degree of soil erosion to an extent that it's sometimes described as soil mining. And so this, you know, is a fundamental contradiction that is has never been resolved. It's overridden with the proliferation of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium fertilizers overwhelmingly. Now that contains a huge resource budget in the production and movement of fertilizer. And so that's, I think, one very fundamental biophysical contradiction in this system. A lot of people might have heard the term peak oil. I guess we're hearing less about it now with all of the, you know, the proliferation of offshore drilling and high Arctic drilling and fracking. But one thing that a lot of people might not have heard of is peak phosphorus. And phosphorus is a fundamental part of how soil health is not restored, but how the degradation of soils is in a way overridden. And so phosphorus, high-grade phosphorus, or there's a limit to that supply. And so that's the term peak phosphorus is highlighting the fact that there are limits to that very fundamental override for degrading soil health. Now, potassium fertilizer, the limits are not nearly so proximate. There's a lot of potash out there to be mined. Nitrogen fertilizer, which is the biggest single inorganic fertilizer on a world scale, is derived through a process that uses overwhelmingly natural gas as the feedstock. It's a very energy-intensive process, and So ultimately, there are resource limits to that story as well. There's a huge energy budget, and there are resource limits in just the story of soil alone. And then with the chemical pesticides, there are limits to not just the energy questions that are embedded in them in terms of the production and movement of pesticides, but also the fact that, you know, superbugs and super weeds evolving. So there's a constant challenge of keeping up with the proliferating pest problems as they respond to the long-term chronic doses of chemicals that are needed to maintain monoculture production. So I think that's another great challenge is the question of keeping up with ever-evolving pest problems. And then there's the question of irrigation. I think, you know, obviously it's been in very stark contrast in California in the past year, and there's a lot of research that suggests irrigation demands in arid regions are going to be massively intensified with climate change in the U.S. West. Large sections of the U.S. West depend upon an ancient aquifer that is not regenerating, the Ogallala Aquifer. So there are proximate water constraints in many parts of the world. And the U.S. is one of the biggest examples of that dependence on aquifers, but there are other cases as well in parts of China, long-term vulnerability to the water supply that is a finite one. And in other cases, the irrigation decline as mid-latitude glaciers decline threatens irrigation supplies in a range of contexts.
So in narrowly economic terms, the picture doesn't look so great.
No, yeah, I think just from in terms of the biophysical contradictions and the resource limits. I mean, I wouldn't want to guess at all of the ways that, you know, technology is responding to various resource questions, because it's that, you know, there's all kinds of innovation happening in the face of this.
That is Tony Wise. He is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Western Ontario and the author of The Ecological Hoofprint, The Global Burden of Industrial Livestock. And you can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I wanted to turn to ask you about how we should understand the ways that the system has emerged. That is a system of livestock production attached to an industrial agricultural system that have had such deleterious consequences, as you've enumerated, you know, over the course of this program. How should we understand our changing relationship with the natural world outside of ourselves, so animals and agriculture as part of it? How do we understand this kind of destruction? Within mainstream environmentalism, the answer most frequently is about population. The population has increased. Larger demand for food means more stress on ecosystems. The term carrying capacity is often used. How useful is this as a way of understanding the form that livestock production has taken and really understanding what drives all of these processes?
Okay, well, The ecological footprint, which obviously, you know, part of the lineage of this name comes from the ecological footprint, was, I think, a valuable contribution in emphasizing that when we're talking about environmental problems, we should not just be talking about population growth. And there's, you know, a long tradition of population-centric environmentalism that kind of places at the center of explanation human population growth. And the footprint was, you know, not saying that population growth is not important. You know, in the early 1800s, there was 1 billion people on Earth. Now we're closing in on 9 to 10 billion people in the coming decades. He wasn't the originators of the footprint weren't saying population is unimportant, but they were saying it needs to be understood in the context of uneven consumption, massively uneven consumption on a world scale, and massively uneven resource budgets and pollution loads that people command. And so that's part of what I think is part of the great value of that conceptual framework, and that's part of what I try to do in the ecological hoofprint, is to say these massively uneven consumption levels with respect to animal products are tied to massively uneven resource budgets and pollution loads. But I also think it's important to think about the implications in terms of how we relate to other species. So to go back to 1960 again, there were less than 10 billion farm animals on Earth. Today there are well over 70 billion animals killed for food every year. So a massive increase in the space of just a half century or so. And if the trajectory of meatification continues, there will be somewhere in the order of 120 billion animals killed for food every year by 2050. And that, the biggest vector of that growth is poultry, which is so heavily industrialized on a world scale. And poultry animals have, very rapid turnover time and smaller bodies. So that's part of the reason why so many individual animals killed in this trajectory of dietary change that I've talked about as meatification, the shift to pigs and poultry, which together alone constitute 70% of animal flesh by volume. Pigs and poultry alone, and poultry there is overwhelmingly chickens. And so there, as I said, 70 billion animals killed for food every year by 2050, 120 billion if that trajectory continues. So one of the things I try and do with the ecological hoofprint is to say, there is a population bomb, to borrow the problematic but influential environmental narrative of Paul Ehrlich, that a lot of environmentalists don't think at all about, and that is livestock, the exploding populations of livestock, which again command a huge share of the world's arable land and very complex resource budgets and pollution loads attended to this. So I think to draw attention to this so-called other population bomb, it's not just a story of population. It's a story of uneven consumption, uneven resource budgets, uneven pollution loads. And it's also a story of our interspecies relations, how animals are vanishing from sight, vanishing from landscapes, vanishing from consciousness at the same time as we're relating to them in ever greater volumes, consuming them in ever greater volumes. And so in many cases, people don't have any sense of how the animals they consume lived and died, the suffering that they endured. And this is a huge break from the long history of animals in agricultural landscapes, when most people would have, if not known the individual animals they consumed or the products of known the individual animals whose products they consumed, they would have at least had a very clear sense of how they lived, and that is fundamentally changing today, again, as animals vanish from landscapes.
And why do you think that's significant?
I think it's significant, I talk about this as a revolution in interspecies relations, that, again, there's long been an important place of animals in agricultural systems, but people would have had relations with animals as labor, animals moving things over space, animals as having a very fundamental role returning nutrients to land, and again that so-called protein factory function that, as Francis Moore Lappe described it. So there was this multifunctional role of animals, and with that there was also an intimacy of people having an awareness of how their lives were tied to the lives of animals whose labor products they depended upon. And now, as I said, people are consuming animals at historically unprecedented levels, and those same animals are vanishing from our landscapes, from our consciousness, and this is a fundamentally different relationship with animals than human societies have ever had before. And I think this relates to the violence of our age, the fact that we are the sorts of environments I've spoken about entail incredible levels of suffering and incredibly invasive procedures from artificial insemination to the suffering in confinement, the suffering in shipment and industrial slaughter, and again at the same time as that is growing in scale, it is vanishing from sight and landscape and consciousness. And so I think humans are dominating environments in ways that are reducing space for other animals to live, at the same time as certain populations of animals are exploding hidden within our landscapes.
Tony Weiss, if we reject, as you do, the assumption that the meatification of our societies is an inevitable, almost natural development, the increasing consumption of meat ever more, then what would demeatification look like?
Yeah, I try not to be too prescriptive here. I think the analysis points to this as a fundamental imperative that the trajectory of increasing per capita consumption of animal flesh needs to be challenged. I think there's no question. But then where is the end point is something I leave a bit more open, and I hope that the at the end of the book, the reader can make sense of the three courses I outlined. The one, as I'd mentioned earlier, Michael Pollan's line of eat food, mostly plants. He implies in that we need to be consuming a lot less meat than average North Americans do. But he does stress there is a need for some animal products because of the functional role that animals have, in his eyes, in sustainable mixed farm systems or permaculture systems. And Simon Fairley, a well-known permaculture figure, has a book called Meat, the Benign Indulgence, where he basically says there's a need to consume some animal products because of the functional role that animals have in permaculture systems.
Is this mainly manure?
Yeah, principally in terms of cycling nutrients and also in converting, making some functional use of things like, crop stubble converting things that are not edible to humans, but, pasture, rotational pasture or various things that are not competitive land uses. Competitive, again, implying, consuming the products of agricultural cultivation rather than byproducts or crop stubble or other things. So that's the one side, the demeatification as meaning, there's a need to consume a lot less, but there are some that argue there's a need for modest amounts of animal products consumption because of the functional role that animals have in mixed farming systems. The vegetarian case is that there is, acknowledges the need for the functional role that animals have in mixed farm systems, but in essence, we can have that functional role without the killing, and vegans would dispute that. But basically acknowledging the functional case for animals in sustainable mixed farm systems at low densities, and that functionality of animals returning condensed nutrients in particular, then involves some consumption, but doesn't necessarily need to involve the killing.
So this would be production of dairy and eggs by the animals, but not their slaughter.
Yeah, and again, vegans would dispute that that is likely to be the end point of that involving animals in agricultural systems. And then the vegan case, of course, is that it's more efficient to derive the nutrition we need from directly from plant-based sources, and that we have no historic precedent of living in a world with 7 billion people, much less 9 to 10 billion people, and that the historic role that animals had in mixed farm systems is not really any guidance for moving forward in the context of a resource-stressed planet and climate change, and that the imperative is to derive nutrition as directly as possible from plants. And so, again, I try not to be prescriptive. I try and make those sort of arguments as fairly as I can, and then hope that at the end of the book, readers will have a sense of where they what they see as the most realistic course. But as you said earlier, I don't want this to just be about individual consumer choice. I think it's the hope is that food opens up a very powerful lens into how productive environments are organized. And as I said, the interspecies relations that inherit and that are invisible in our societies. And my hope is that, I do think consumption choices matter, but I also hope they can open up into much more radical systemic critiques.
Well, ending on that then, what would an environmental movement or social movement orientation look like that took into account these questions through the lens of radical political economy or radical political ecology that saw inequality and these environmental questions as connected?
One of the biggest hopes with the book is to emphasize how our diets tie us to very powerful environmental implications or socio-ecological relations in terms of, as I stress, the unevenness of our consumption ties to unevenness of resource budgets, pollution loads, and also the suffering of individual animals. And something I haven't discussed yet today is also the exploitation of labor in these environments. And there's all kinds of great research that's been done on the violence that I've been talking about of these productive environments for animals also relates to incredibly exploitative work environments for people working in industrial settings of industrial livestock, both the factory farms and slaughterhouses. So I think diet and food is a powerful way of kind of opening up critical thinking about how productive environments are organized in terms of social relations, in terms of interspecies relations, how we relate to other animal lives on this planet, how we the uneven resource budgets, pollution loads we command, and also the exploitation of workers in these environments, and my hope is that that it's not just when we think about change, our own consumption decisions that matter at some level, but that we also see them in relation to broader struggles. And I think for me, this is something that needs to be a fundamental part of broader struggles for climate justice, for social justice. I don't want to sort of leave off with the thought of individual consumption decisions as the end goal.
Tony Weiss has been my guest. He is the author of The Ecological Hoofprint, The Global Burden of Industrial Livestock, published by Zed Books. He's Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Western Ontario and also author of The Global Food Economy, The Battle for the Future of Farming. Tony, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
During World War II, John Steinbeck, one of my favorite fiction writers, wrote The Moon Is Down. This work was so accurate to real life that real veterans of the resistance later asked Steinbeck how he, an American writer, had snuck into Denmark and snuck back out, his account so true that real veterans thought Steinbeck really witnessed it. Steinbeck and others have argued that the Danish resistance to the Nazis hasn't gotten the credit it deserves. Some go so far as to say the Danish resistance was the pivotal factor that crippled the Nazi war machine, diverting resources and turning the tide in the war. The Danes practiced sabotage, from the word sabo for shoe, referring to the widespread practice of throwing shoes into the machinery. At the onset of the occupation, the Nazis overestimated Danish support for the war, for the Nazi war effort. At the onset of the occupation, the Nazis overestimated Danish support for the Nazi war effort and set up critical munitions factories in occupied Denmark. Big mistake. The Danes resisted. One key component to the popularizing the resistance was one particular handbill that was printed on a mimeograph machine. A nationalist appeal, the handbill was produced by the thousands and was everywhere in occupied Denmark. Across the top of the handbill were the words, "Be good Danes." Below that, a laundry list of things for good Danes to do. Chief among them, to disrupt the Nazi war effort. If you worked in the munitions factories, break the machines. If the machines were repaired, make bombs that won't explode. Never give Nazis information. Harbor resistors. But most importantly, in the course of everyday life, seek out those millions of small ways you can disrupt the Nazi occupation and make it burdensome. It worked. It worked fantastically. The Nazis faced a situation where they had to place a soldier on every man, woman, and child in the country. So some high-ranking Nazis went to the King of Denmark and demanded, at gunpoint, that he make a radio address ordering his countrymen to cooperate with the Nazis and end the campaign of sabotage. The King of Denmark agreed, But, he said, he would have to write his own script for the radio address, arguing that his people would know if he was reading some disingenuous statement prepared for him. So the King of Denmark wrote his own radio address and got it approved by the Nazi commander. The King of Denmark told his fellow countrymen to do as the Nazis ordered. He ended his radio address imploring every listener, above all else, to be good Danes. Even the King of Denmark had seen that handbill. The Nazis had no idea what the King of Denmark had just pulled on them, that he had really inspired everyone to heighten their level of resistance. On the following day, they didn't get the compliance they expected. Instead, sabotage and disruption, sniping and ambushes were worse than ever. Widespread sabotage took down the Nazi occupation and was a decisive factor in the Nazi defeat. I think we greatly underestimate the power of sabotage, the millions of little acts of resistance that every one of us can perform in the course of daily life, the small, low-risk activities that accumulate over time, creating bottlenecks and slowdowns and disruptions in the systems of production and distribution. We underestimate our power, the power of one individual throwing a shoe, the power of one individual throwing a shoe into the machinery. The Nazi munitions factory counts on all of us to do our jobs, to comply, to obey. The occupiers circle the fence line of our lives with their rifles, demanding our allegiance and cooperation. But they can't see everything, and they can't be everywhere. It's so easy to throw a shoe into the machine, and we have so many shoes. I think of the slogan of the best-selling shoe, just do it. Yes, just do it. This is Anarchist Prisoner Sean Swain from somewhere inside the American Torture Complex. If you're listening, be good Danes. Yeah.